Good morning, everybody. Buenos dias. It is October the 26th, 2016. I'm calling the Dallas City Council meeting to order for our agenda today. We are very honored to have for our invocator this morning an important pastor in southern Dallas, Pastor Kenneth King of Mount Carmel Missionary Baptist Church. Pastor King has served as the pastor of the church in South Dallas since June 2013. He is a graduate of Aspen Theological Seminary and has worked in the communities of White Rock and Denison. Pastor King is a member of the North Texas District Brotherhood Union, the Oak Cliff Ministers Union, National Baptist Convention USA, Dallas Minority Adoption Agency, South Dallas Fair Park Faith Coalition, NAACP Association of Baptist Churches, Texas Baptist Association, and Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Following the invocation, Councilwoman Gates will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Pastor King, would you come on up, and would everybody rise for the invocation?
Let us pray. God, our Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for life, health, and strength, for we recognize that it's in you that we live, move, and have our existence. Now focus our mind on the less, the least, and those who are less fortunate. We ask, oh God, that you would bless our city, bless our mayor, bless this council, God, that we would do those things that would be pleasing in your sight. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Good morning. We'll start by listening to you. Ms. Rios will take our open microphone speakers.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Our first five registered speakers are Yamile Pereira, Virginia Bradford, William Hopkins, Ashton Elder, and David Villalobos. I will first recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks will be removed from the session of the meeting. Individuals are allowed 2 minutes to speak. You'll notice the timer at the podium. When your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. You should state your name and address for the record, as well as address your comments to Mayor Rawlings. Again, your first speaker is Yamilet Pereira. Ms. Pereira? Ms. Pereira will be followed by Virginia Bradford, William Hopkins, Ashton Elder, and David Villalobos.
Okay. Hello. Good morning, Mayor Rawlings and council members. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Yamile Pereira. I am a young member of Texas Organizing Project, and I live at 3420 El Benito Drive. I do not want to leave my home. I am currently a senior at L.G. Pinkston High School. Before Pinkston, I attended Lorenzo Isabella Elementary and Thomas A. Edison Middle School. All are in West Dallas. I have lived here in this community all my life. Last month, my mom got a notice in the mail saying that we had to leave our home by October 31st. It took me a while to understand how serious the situation was. I see these types of things happen on the news, but I never thought it would happen to my family. The hardest thing for me is seeing my mom worry and stress so much about where we are going to live. My mom has raised me by herself these first 17 years of my life. It's been tough for both of us, but we've managed to get through together. But I honestly don't know how we'll get through this one. I've been going to school every day with knots in my stomach. I don't think it is fair that I have to go through this my senior year of high school. I have waited so long for this moment, and it's like, It really hurts me, you know, to see this going on right now. So, last year as a junior, I applied to the City of Dallas Mayor's internship. It was a long process, but I was excited to get accepted. So, during the interview, I had the pleasure of meeting you, Mayor Rawlings. I still remember going home and running to my mom to tell her that I had met the mayor. To me, sir, it felt like it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So when people in my neighborhood talk bad about you, I don't want to believe them. I want to believe that you support our neighborhood and families. I want to believe that you would do everything you can to keep us in our homes. Everything I've ever needed, I've had in West Dallas. West Dallas is a big part of me. West Dallas has shaped the person that I am today. I come today to ask you to please meet with our families. My mom has worked hard to pay the rent on time. She could not afford to miss work this morning to see me speak. Mayor Rawlings, we deserve to stay in our homes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next speaker.
Ms. Pereira, you speak the truth, and I'll be glad to meet with you and your mother, okay? Thank you.
Virginia Bradford.
Good morning, Mayor and members on the council. I am Virginia Bradford. My address is 1408 Brookvalley Lane, Dallas, Texas. And I'm speaking today as a member of Mothers Against Police Brutality. Our group has created a set of 9 reforms to change police work. My subject today is one of our proposals. What should happen after a police officer kills someone? When there is a deadly police shooting, the officer involved should be taken off patrol and disarmed until all investigation into the shootings are complete. It only makes sense to keep the officers off regular duty until the grand jury, which is the last local review, has its say in the case. Too often, an officer who kills someone is back on patrol with his gun before the county grand jury has even heard the case. The officer who killed a Latina man named Elias Petula last August was placed back on duty only after 14 days. The grand jury has not reviewed the case even today. More than a month after the officer went back on patrol. Until the grand jury rules on a case of an officer involved shooting, it in fact could be a murder. How will you feel if this officer shoots someone else before the other killing is unresolved, is still unresolved? No policy that you make will bring my son back. My son was not shot by a Dallas officer. No, but a Dallas officer killed my son all the same. My son, Fred Bradford, was riding his bike on the night of April the 21st, 2013, in South Dallas. About after 10:45, a Dallas officer ran over Fred, and he was taken to Baylor, where he died of multiple injuries. But he lived long enough to tell me what the officer said to him and how he done him. And for 23 days, while my son was laying in the hospital with every bone in his body broken, the officer who ran over him was on regular patrol. It was more than 2 weeks before he was even placed on leave. Nothing you can do on this council will bring my son back, but you should work with our group to make changes and make this change and others so at least a fair investigation the next time a police officer shoots a person to death or kills someone, they can be held accountable. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you for coming.
William Hopkins. Mr. Hopkins will be followed by Ashton Elder and David Villalobos.
Good morning, Mr. Hopkins.
Good morning. I'm giving out a handout. Can I wait? Can I wait?
No, go ahead. We'll get it. We'll get it as you go through.
I want you to have it. I want you to have it before I speak. Can I wait until I get it, until they give you the handout?
Mr. Hopkins, just talk to me. Go ahead.
Okay. What they're giving out is a lawsuit where the city of Dallas sued the RSR lead smelter in 85. And the city got the money for the people of West Dallas. You're getting a handout right now. Everybody getting a handout. So just like when Scott Griggs took over Miss Arnold District, I'm looking for somebody to take over Miss Alonzo District and help these people that's behind me from West Dallas that's dying from the lead, and you finna put them out, and the city got the money. Mayor Rollins, you've been on this 5 years. You're sitting up here playing like you're going to meet with this lady's parents and all that. Your family owns slaves. So you've been on this 5 years that these people need help. The city got the money. They sued. You got it right now. Went through court and everything. So what the city do was so racist and bigot, give Fred Bowron and Russell Budd the money and let them pick pay the people, John Wiley Price, bring them to the boys' club, tell them don't tell nobody. So these people won't know that they got help. So they go to the boys' club and don't tell nobody and get millions of dollars from the boys' club with Russell Budd, Dorothy Budd, Lisa Blue, and here you go. Dorothy Budd, Russell Budd, Lisa Blue, and Russell Budd, and Fred Bowron. This is what it is, Fred Bowron and Budd Law Firm. They got the money. The city got the money to help these people since 95. You're sitting on the money, letting these people die, letting them get put out of their house. Russell Budd and them just got honored for the rebuilding of West Dallas. Russell Budd and Dr. Budd just got honored for the rebuilding of, and building houses in West Dallas. That's the money they stole, they stole and got the money from the city. The city already got the money to help these people right now due to this lawsuit. All y'all got it. You've been having it 5 years. Your family owns slaves. You letting the people die in West Dallas. You finna let these people get put out, and the city got the money. They sued and got the money for the people from the RSR lead plant. You got it in your hand right now. And the state. The state is a Confederate. Texas is a Confederate state. So the Confederates and the state bar didn't say nothing about the lawsuit. The city and the state sued. The city and the state got the money. Letting the people die in West Dallas, y'all finna let them get put out in West Dallas, and y'all got millions of dollars for the people. You've been doing this 5 years. I went to a meeting with Ms. Alonzo. They told Ms. Alonzo that the people, that some box that they're supposed to be helping these people got lost. Ms. Alonzo know it. She won't help the Hispanics. She letting the Hispanics die. She know the city got the money. I had a meeting with her and the attorneys. Ms. Alonzo know the city got the money. Know these Hispanics need help, and they're going to get put out. And the city got the money. Ms. Alonzo know it. I went to a meeting with her. The city attorney told her that the city got the money. Some boxes got lost or got burned up. A whole lot of hogwash. Won't nobody get the FBI? All you have to do is ask the FBI to look at the papers y'all got in y'all hand. Mr. Alonzo, you can help these Hispanic people. I'll help the blacks. You help the Hispanics.
Thank you, Mr.
This will be over with.
Right.
Your next speaker, Ashton Elder. Ashton Elder will be followed by David Villalobos.
Good morning. My name is Ashton Elder. I am a top member, and I live at 3428 El Benito Drive. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys this morning. Thank you, Mayor and Council members. As a proud resident of Dallas, I do not want to leave my home. I have been a West Dallas resident all of my life. This is more than just a neighborhood to me. It's a closely knit, hardworking community with its own unique personality. I walk my kids every day to school, and I still see the teachers that taught me. And it's, I was truly blindsided when I read the letter that stated I was being evicted. I pay my rent on time. I do what I'm supposed to do as a tenant, even though HMK has neglected our families and their responsibilities for many years. They have taken advantage of us knowing that we don't have many options for us who are working hard just to make ends meet. I feel it is unfair for our families to be caught in the middle of between the city and HMK. We deserve to live in a city where affordable housing is more accessible. We deserve this affordable housing to be dignified in the neighborhood that we've called home for generations, and that allows our opportunity to raise our families without sacrificing our humanity. The city took a great step in direction of the tenants' rights by creating standards for rental properties. But your responsibilities does not end there. We seek a genuine pathway to home ownership. Some of us have lived in these homes for over 30 years. Last week, Mayor Rollins, we delivered a letter stating that I would like a meeting with you. I'm partially reiterating that proposal at this moment. in order for this, excuse me, I'm very, want to meet with you in order to find a solution to this crisis. It is hard to describe the pain that I feel when my kids ask me, Mama, do we have to move? Our families are the ones physically and mentally suffering every day. We deserve our seat at the table, mayor, city council members. We deserve to stay in our homes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your next speaker, David Villalobos. Mr. Villalobos will be the final speaker this morning. All other individuals will be called in the afternoon.
Good morning, Mayor Rawlings, fellow council members. My name is David Villalobos. I live at 1222 Commerce Street. I am a community organizer for the Texas Organizing Project, a statewide organization with over 100,000 members and supporters. West Dallas is a gem of its own. It incorporates a community where families have spent generations living. The more I meet residents from West Dallas and hear their inspiring stories, the more I believe it will be saved from the development that is headed their way. As you've heard earlier this morning, there are many stories to be told from the residents living in West Dallas. I've had the pleasure of meeting Ms. Pace, who is 85 years old and has been living in the same house on Rutt Street for 43 years. Most of her kids and grandkids were raised in Los Altos neighborhood. Moving at the age of 85 is not something Ms. Pace was looking forward to. She genuinely believed she would take her last breath in West Dallas. Another tenant, Ms. Pearl, has lived all of her 80 years of life in the same part of West Dallas, in three different homes, all within a six-block radius. Ms. Pearl is a fighter. She knocked on over 30 doors last Saturday trying to rally her neighborhood. Her mom would have turned 100 this coming month, but she just recently passed away. Ms. Pearl's mom, too, lived all her life in the neighborhood. Mayor Rawlings, I invite you to walk a few blocks with us in West Dallas and personally meet the people that are on the brink of losing their homes that are dear to them. The persistence and resilience of these families show me that West Dallas is more than just a neighborhood. It is a strong community built on hard work and the values that drive us as Americans. It's no secret that there's a lack of affordable housing in the city of Dallas. Most of residents facing evictions have lived under the tutelage of two families, the Wheelers and Crushes. This does not seem right in a country where we pride ourselves on being the most just society. The current landscape has created an inclination of people to be exploited by landlords because of their economic disadvantage. There's too much at stake, too little time. We need to find a permanent solution for these families. We can't be treating tenants as chess pieces, and I ask all of our fellow councilmen and women to follow suit and do what is right by the people. Mayor Rawlings, we ask you to please honor our request to meet with the families that are affected. The tenants of West Dallas have made it clear that they want a pathway to home ownership. They have made it clear that they do not wish to lose their identity. We need the city of Dallas to immediately work on obtaining dignified, affordable housing. The people that are most affected by this process need a seat at the negotiation table. They deserve to not only stay in their homes, but own them as well. Mayor Rawlings, we hope to meet with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, those are your final speakers this morning.
Thank you. We'll begin with agenda. Thank you all for coming down and speaking to us about this important subject.
Agenda item number one is approval of minutes of the October 11, 2016 City Council meeting.
We have motion and second. Any edits, additions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is carried.
We do have...
Hey, before we go to the consent agenda, just from a process standpoint, Council, I think, who knows, we have a tendency at times to take lamp-tan turns here, but I think we'll be done with the morning agenda by 11:15. We're going to break at that point. Councilman Thomas has an event out in the plaza that he had asked us all to do, to come to, which is very important for his district, and I think it'll be exciting. Then we will meet back in the lunchroom for executive session at 1 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, everybody will be back there, and then we'll have our executive session and take up our afternoon agenda at that time. Thank you. Ms. Rios.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We do have two registered speakers on agenda items 36, 37, and 38. They will be called in order to address all items. Your first speaker is Charles Hillman. Mr. Hillman will be followed by B.L. Gamble. Charles Hillman? Not present. B.L. Gamble? There's a gentleman coming down. I'm not sure if that's Hillman. Okay. The gentlemen are not present. Therefore, I'm going to go ahead and present the consent agenda. There have been changes, Mayor and Council, from the list that was distributed last night. Your consent agenda consists of agenda items number 2 through 46 and addendum items number 1 through 3. Agenda item 5 is pulled for individual consideration by Councilmember Kingston. Agenda item 9 by Councilmember Kingston and Young. Councilmember 10 by Councilmembers Kingston and Grayson. Agenda item 26 by Councilmembers Grayson and Young, as well as the City Manager. Agenda item number 38 is pulled by Councilmember Kingston. Agenda item 40 is deleted on the addendum. Agenda item number 3, Councilmember Clayton is requesting the item be deferred to November 9, 2016. Therefore, remaining for approval on the consent are agenda items number 2 through 4, 6 through 8, 11 through 25, 27 through 37, 39, 41 through 46, and addendum items 1 and 2.
Thank you. I'll entertain a motion. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 5 is authorize a 3-year professional services contract with 2 1-year renewal options for spay-neuter services, spay-neuter network, most qualified respondent of 3, not to exceed $2,037,178. Councilmember Kingston, pull the item.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion second. Any discussion? Mr. Kingston?
Just briefly, Mr. Mayor, I'm really happy to see the movement on this issue. This is increased funding for spay-neuter, which we should have done quite a while ago. And this is, as we've seen from the Boston Consulting study, this is what's going to really be the key to solving our problem with loose dogs. I couldn't be happier today. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 9 is authorized a 3-year service contract for temporary day labor, Lane Staffing, Inc., most advantageous proposer of 5, not to exceed $14,783,393. Council members Kingston and Young, pull the item.
Thank you, Ms. Gates. I'll entertain a motion.
Motion for approval.
Second.
The motion is second. Discussion, Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Staff got me a lot of good answers on this, but I wanted them to explain what they're doing because this is a huge amount of money for day labor, really. And so this is 9?
This is 9.
Oh, okay. I thought I was crazy. I'd like staff to explain what the strategy is with regard to day labor and how they're ensuring that these are living wage positions and how we're going to integrate the panhandling initiative that Councilmember Medrano raised during the budget process.
Yes, sir. This is a 3-year contract. It went through a competitive process, and we do have the wage floor, 1037, that's required on all contracts as of October 2016. The billable rate, as we discussed, to the city is $13.43 an hour. So that includes all of their FICA, FUTA, federal employment tax, state employment tax, and a margin of about 9%. The Panhandle Initiative was not part of the proposal, but the current incumbent, Carla Lane and Lane Staffing, who's the owner, that works today with local churches, and she does training at the Texas Workforce Commission to ensure that anybody that's out there that's underserved in the community has the ability to come in and do these low-skilled jobs. And she continued and pledged to do that as well on this contract. And she's here today if you'd like to have her speak on that. She's a minority-owned firm. We're glad to have her here. And she's also subcontracting with a minority firm.
I think, Mr. Frosch, that staff has done a nice job of responding to sort of late-in-the-game questions from council on stuff like this, and I really appreciate it. I think that I'd like to see us whittle this number down in the future. It still seems like a really high number, but I appreciate what you and really all the other departments who fed into this contract did on this deal. I think it's good work. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Ms. Young.
Yes, thank you. My questions are along the same lines, and one, I wanted to point out that I had been told that the Lane Agency does, in fact, hire formerly incarcerated individuals, so we wanted to get that on the record for those that are looking for employment, that is a place they can go to. The next question is about the Panhandling Initiative, and you've already talked a little about it, but I guess when we talked about it during budget season, I remember we said that there was money either in water or aviation. Where are we with that? When will we see that come to fruition if it's not in this contract?
Well, this contract is a citywide contract for temporary labor for as-needed use of other departments. So there may be some allocation for staffing, for temporary staffing, but I'm not specifically aware of anything.
The first part of that is that we did not have that included in the provisions on this. This was already kind of going on before we had those other conversations. Within the next month or so, we're going to have some monies identified from the different departments that might be able to make use of this. We haven't put that out there because there's still some concerns about just how we would do it in a way that doesn't get us into other difficulties as far as exposures to some liability, et cetera. We've seen it work in cleaning up some areas that have been very successful, and we just want to make sure that we got it all laid out nicely before we go out there and do it in a more formal way.
Have there been any formal conversations with the program that was mentioned where the mayor in another city was doing it or another state? Have you all had any conversations with that?
I think we saw the information about, I think it was Albuquerque that was doing it in particular, but others that have looked into it, and I know that there's been some follow-up. I'm not aware of it directly, but we will be coming back to the council with some information within the next month.
Thank you.
Thank you. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 10. Is authorize a 5-year service contract for financial advisory services, Hilltop Securities, Inc., in the amount of $75,000, and Estrada Hinojosa and Company, Inc., in the amount of $50,000 proposed jointly, and PFM Financial Advisors, LLC, in the amount of $375,000, most advantageous proposers of three. Council members Kingston and Grayson, pull the item.
Thank you, Ms. Gates.
Move for approval.
The motion is second. Any discussion? Mr. Kingston.
Can we have management describe it, colleagues, so you'll know, previously we had done our GO bond sales through Hilltop, which was formerly First Southwest, who I believe also represents DART and DFW Airport. I think that is a conflict of interest. I'm actually sort of embarrassed that I didn't notice it before it was brought to our attention when we were trying to evaluate DART's financial plan, and we didn't have an independent source of advice on that plan. So could management please describe how they will save us from that embarrassing conflict of interest in the future?
So
So this contract actually splits the financial advisor role into two different groups. One of those groups is on the general obligation bonds, and in this contract it's PFM. And the second is for the other, water and sewer and airport. And so those are a joint proposal that came in from Estrada Hinojosa and Hilltop.
It's an interesting answer. It's not really exactly responsive. Okay.
Part of the reason that we offered it in two separate credits was primarily to stimulate competition for the services. We've seen changes in the really since 2008 where one large financial advisor in this area has gotten out of the business and, in fact, merged with Hilltop. That would be Southwest Securities, and other smaller financial advisors have come along and indicated to us that they might not have the capacity to deal with us in all of our scope of our needs. So looking around at what others had done, we saw that Houston had offered theirs as separate credits, that San Antonio has a pool of financial advisors. It's not unusual for state agencies to use more than one. So we thought we'd try that and see if we could, and as I said, stimulate competition and also see what other things might come out of that. We had already started down the road of looking at conflicts of interest in the previous contract, where we became concerned that formerly First Southwest Company were financial advisors to both Tarrant Regional Water District and to the city and through Dallas Water Utilities, and that contract that we have with Tarrant Regional Water District to build the pipeline to Lake Palestine. And we prohibited First Southwest Company from serving as financial advisor to Dallas Water Utilities in that contract, and have been watchful ever since then. In other circumstances, this would formalize that concern.
Let me present you with a hypothetical. Maybe it'll make it a little more clear. Should DART bid out its FA work, or DFW Airport bid out its FA work, or any other party with whom we do business bid out its FA work, and PFM were to bid on that work, could we fire them, like the next week?
We would look, I think, at what we have in terms of interagency agreements with those entities to determine whether they should continue to work on that particular, should we end up doing a joint financing with them or end up in some kind of financing arrangement with them. We would take a look at that and see if we needed to forbid them to work on that and represent us as well.
So it's more of a narrow question. If we determine in our judgment that there is a conflict of interest, is the contract terminable at will?
I'd have to ask the city attorney's office to address that.
That does sound like a city attorney question.
Bob Sands from the city attorney's office. Yes, our contracts allow for a termination of the contract if there is a conflict of interest. Recently, the city has expanded its definition of conflict of interest to include situations where the vendor might have a business relationship with another party that might impair its independent judgment. So we've expanded the definition for conflict of interest to cover those kinds of situations. But the city manager has the ability to terminate the contract if he determines that there is a conflict of interest. Secondly, the second option would be to allow for the vendor to withdraw from representation of the other party that's in conflict with the city. So that's the second way. And then, but I think the most important thing is that we now have two teams of financial advisors. So if there is a conflict with one team, the second team may be able to step in. And
well, that actually won't be the case because the second team is the one with the conflict. So, yeah, don't do that.
Under your scenario.
Other than that last part, that was a good answer. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ms. Grayson.
So you say that the determination of a conflict is up to the city manager.
Yes, it is.
Solely the city manager.
Yes.
And so if a council member raises a concern, they go to the city manager and say, you need to make a determination on this?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Alonzo.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. it's kind of interesting that I believe that these companies have been with us for a while, correct? So,
yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yes. So, if I understand correctly, in order for them to bid, in order for them to be considered, they have to go through a process. And the process is, if there's conflicts and they cannot bid, we would let them know. Am I correct?
Yes, we would.
Okay.
Let them know.
So because they applied, they bid, and they were considered, therefore, that means that there's no conflicts. Am I correct?
At the time that we considered them, that would be correct. As issues arise, a conflict may arise, and just like in any of our lives, where when that happens, we disclose it, we would be expecting to have that conversation and to take a look at it.
Okay. But they've been here with us before. Was there ever a conflict?
I'll have to turn to folks who've been here longer.
They've represented the city as a joint arrangement since 1995. First Southwest Company's been financial advisor to the city for much longer than that. The only conflict that I would know about would be the one that we recognized during the previous contract, which was, again, related to Tarrant Regional Water District. And we wrote into the contract that we would have the right not to use them if we needed to have a financial advisor to represent Dallas Water Utilities. So that was recognized at the time, and I believe it was recognized that this contract is about to be signed.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we clarified, because we don't want to say we want you to work with us, but we don't want you to do this. And I think that that's important.
It's not a matter of not wanting them to do this.
Respectfully, I'm sorry. Respectfully. Okay. Also, we want to make sure that we recognize, and if I understand correctly, they're local, correct?
They are.
Local companies, big firm companies from the city, in the city, live in the city, pay taxes, et cetera. I'm sure they have employees in the city from the city, correct?
They do.
I mean, I don't know if you asked those questions. I know you have some information here, and I just wanted to make sure we clarify that as well, or we recognize that.
Yes.
Because it's important. I know that in procurement, right, Mr. Wilson, we make sure that we want to have inclusiveness. We want to make sure that we consider local as much as possible. There's a process. I understand that. But also recognizing and acknowledging, because I'm not sure if you consider when you make these decisions as far as points are concerned, that they are local, that they employ local. I mean, here we are talking about employment. We're talking about making sure that, you know, there's inclusiveness and vibrancy, et cetera. So we wanted to make sure that that was addressed. I saw that, and that's why I'm addressing it, and I wanted to make sure that that was mentioned, because it's important that we say we want to do business with X, Y, and Z because they're doing a good job. And there's a saying very clearly that if it's not broken, why fix it? Am I correct?
That is a saying,
Thank
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kingston.
So, Ms. Teager, you wouldn't classify as a conflict my inability to get independent financial advice on DART's financial plan? That wasn't a conflict?
I don't know if I'd classify that as a conflict or not, as much as, again, it's the issue, you're right, the issue of independence is important, and asking our existing relationship, well, the relationship that was existing at the time, what they thought about DART's financial plan might have been difficult for them to provide.
Say that's an understatement. Okay, well, we're getting to good answers eventually. Thank you.
Okay.
Ms. Grayson.
Yes, can you tell me, is there language specifically in these contracts that we're going to be asked to approve right now related to potential contracts? I mean, is there language in there in these contracts that says, if a potential conflict is identified, the city manager will make a determination?
Yes, there is.
It is specifically says that in each one of these contracts?
Yes, it is.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. I will defer to the wisdom of the city manager and the budget committee on this item. We'll be supporting their motion. It concerns me. Mike, maybe this is kind of a line of questioning for you that I just kind of have learned about, that you have a bid and then we have a proposal. And the bid we can take into account if somebody is a local company, and a proposal we can't because of state law?
Right. The local preference has specific guidelines, and in the proposal process for this particular service, it's not applicable. The BID program or inclusion program is for all proposals, so it is included in this particular evaluation. So we had 15 points for the inclusion program, but it doesn't necessarily say they're a local business, although they both have local offices here.
Okay, so maybe I misheard. So it did take into account your findings that this was a local company with local employees, with local taxpaying base.
It took into account that they had inclusion under the city's inclusion program. We had 15 points out of 100 in the evaluation criterion, but it's not specifically for local Dallas businesses. But they both have local offices, and they're both large presence.
Mr. Gonzalez.
Let's just be a little bit more clear. There's local preference. There's a question about whether or not local offices, or et cetera, is one particular criteria that some people would want to look at. There's the other with regards to the employment or the ownership as it represents ethnic or racial groups, et cetera, gender, and which is in the bid program.
Yes.
So those are the two considerations that are there. Now, you answered the question, the question was being asked was just in regards to the consideration of local preference.
Right.
Just don't even talk about the other category. In terms of local preference, we include that in some situations having to do with bids.
Right, it's not in this particular
but
situation.
But in proposals, yes, it's not, yes, that is not considered.
And we can't make a decision for a local company because the state won't allow us to do it?
If I might, we can't include it in our analysis as far as giving points to that process. Now, whether or not the council
So the internal process can't do it because of state.
It's my understanding.
State law has some provisions that are specific on which you can use local preference. The criterion can be crafted based on the need of the organization. At this point, the criterion included the inclusion program, but not local preference. Yes, sir.
It concerns me as we are putting strategic relationships together, regardless of conflict or not, I mean, that's a whole other subject, that we cannot be loyal to people that are part of our city, employ many people, and not just hanging out a shingle. It's anathema to me that that's the way you want to support businesses. And you're telling me that we can't do that. I mean, we can do that at the council level, but we can't, you as management can't take that into consideration as you make recommendations.
That's my understanding.
Correct.
I know we're going to be voting on our legislative agenda in a moment, but it seems to me, I know we'll probably not win that one, but boy, I mean, we've got to be supportive of our community if it's all, everything else is equal. I'm not trying to shortchange anyone. So that just, for the record, it really concerns me. Okay?
Mayor,
so thank you, Ms. Alonzo.
Can we hold it to consider it further, or is that something that needs to be done right away?
No. Well, you can make any motion you want.
But I'm asking a question in regards to that. I'm asking a question.
What was the question?
Can we hold it, or does it have to go through today?
We're currently without a financial advisor for the city, and so it's really imperative that we have a financial advisor on board as soon as possible.
Thank you. All right. All in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 26 is authorized adoption of the City of Dallas State Legislative Program for the 85th session of the Texas Legislature. Council members Grayson and Young and the City Manager pull the item.
Thank you. Mr. Kleinman.
Motion to approve.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion. Ms. Grayson.
My question related to the addition of the statute of repose. What it says is the Dallas City Council favors home ownership amongst its residents. As such, the City of Dallas will be asking the state legislature to reduce the statute of repose for multifamily owner-occupied construction from 10 to 5 years. My one question relates to the word multifamily. Why is multifamily in there if our goal is to encourage single-family home ownership? And I would be reluctant to have multifamily developers be relieved of their responsibility from 10 years down to 5 years. So I'd just like an explanation for that.
The term multifamily could also use multi-unit. I think the concept was to address townhouses.
I'm sorry, can you start over again?
Sure. The term
slow down a little
multifamily could have been stated as multi-unit to include condos and townhouses for home ownership.
But many, many condos are zoned multifamily and are rented out. So they're rental units. They're not single family. And that's meant to address condos.
My understanding was that this was to address builders that worked in the condo and the townhouse industry to allow them to have a product for home ownership.
Townhouse is not multifamily. Townhouse is single family. So why is the word multifamily in here?
Well, as I stated, I think it could be better worded as multi-unit rather than multifamily.
Is there a significant difference between multi-unit and multi-family, other than just a different term? Is it a difference without a distinction?
I think it's probably a difference without a distinction, except for multi-family does connote rental more than multi-unit does.
I just don't see having the word multi-family in there as being compatible with our stated goals, which is to increase single-family home ownership. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Young. Mr. Kingston, excuse me.
This is my bright idea, so I'll try to explain it. I apologize to those of you who had questions. I've been out of town. I didn't have time to come talk to you. Here's the issue. We have something on the order of 25 current multifamily construction projects going on in the City of Dallas right now. All but one of them are rental. We're going to have more multifamily in the future. Our stated goal as a council is owner-occupant, not single-family. That's our actual policy. So the point is the market will not finance owner-occupied multifamily or multi-unit properties because of the 10-year statute of repose that Texas imposes on everybody who touches the project, developer, architect, builder, financer. In some cases, I've seen limited partners get sued. And so what these developers have told me is that they're not interested in even looking at an owner-occupied project because of the litigation risk. And that's unfortunate because all this stuff going up in Uptown right now could be owner-occupied. And the fact that somebody rents a condo from time to time is not troubling to me when compared to a project that is 100% rental. So the point is to try to get more owner-occupied product in our local mix. We have a distortion in the market because the financing sources will not invest in owner-occupied product. The idea here is to reduce the amount of time people have to find out about a construction defect and then sue over it from 10 to 5 years. That's still a year longer than they have to sue over almost any other thing in the state of Texas. If somebody robs you using deception and it takes you years to find out about it because they've covered it up, you only have 4 years to sue them over that. So this five-year deal is a real, it really takes this area of the law into line with other tort-based claims. And the point was basically to encourage the production of owner-occupied product in the city of Dallas. Because I think that's really what we're talking about. At least in my neighborhoods, that's what we're talking about. We don't have really blank lots to do more single family. So what we would like is to convert a lot of the area where currently we only see renters. And renters are great. They just tend to be more transient and less involved in our city. So the chance to give them the opportunity to have product that they want, which we see that they want it because they're renting it, and a chance to buy it, I think is the way forward for the core of the city. So that was the idea behind it. I think we've got at least one sponsor in the House, and I'm working on the Senate side, so hopefully it might have some legs. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ms. Young.
Yes, thank you for the explanation, Councilman Kingston. I guess I'm still somewhat confused as to how a reduction from 10 years to 5 years gets us there, and I was a little concerned we hadn't discussed this as a member of the Housing Committee or where this came from. And so I guess my question is, how does it affect our vote today? Because I'm not willing to support this today as a part of the legislative package. So
I think you have a motion and a second on the floor for the whole package, and I guess you would need to discuss whether this gets included or not procedurally.
Okay, I'll listen to
it. Mr. Kleinman.
Thank you, Mayor. I am a little, a couple questions. First of all, does the City of Dallas make a distinction when it comes to multifamily, whether it's owner, occupied, or rental in all its ordinances and zoning and things like that?
I can speak to the zoning part of it, and no, we do not make a distinction. It's actually a distinction is based on the building itself. So if it's multi-unit, then it's multifamily under the zoning code.
And one of the concerns I have about reducing the time on this does seem reasonable, but one of the concerns I do have is about owner-occupied multifamily. While it is important for people to have home ownership, we have certainly found in many cases where in the city apartments have been converted to condominiums that when it's time for those a redevelopment of that area, then there's a few folks. You need 100% of the folks to participate in the willingness because there's a common ownership of the underlying land. So I'm not quite sure where I am on this thing because I do want to encourage home ownership, but I'm not real thrilled about encouraging home ownership and multifamily units. The new ones, yeah, Mr. Kingston, I'll grant you we're probably in good condition there, but the older ones, you know, the 50, 60-year-old apartments that are being converted into home ownership units, maybe not the highest and best use. So kind of struggling with it, but thank you for your feedback on it.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is, we've had a lot of discussion around home ownership, and that's something we would, the city endorses. But is it official policy? Do we have it written anywhere that it's official policy? Because I know we haven't even adopted a housing policy. So where does it exist that we have a stated policy that we want to encourage home occupied ownership, I think is the way it says. Home occupied ownership. So, Bernadette, where does that exist on this?
So far, what you passed early in January was a owner occupied development program, which is what we were operating our funding under right now. But the anticipated adoption of the full housing policy will have it in there.
Right. It was mentioned in the introduction to the housing policy, but we haven't adopted that yet.
Correct.
Okay. So we have a program that encourages home, that we all adopted, a program because we want to be able to have people. And I think when we adopted that program to encourage people to own the homes they lived in, they occupied, we had a discussion about if multifamily condos and townhomes could qualify. And I think we included them. Is that right?
We did, yes.
Okay. So we do, it involves, you can own a townhome or a condo, and
correct,
you can benefit from this program.
Correct.
Okay. So I don't disagree that this is something that the city is endorsed. I mean, we have a program that we provide. We're looking at putting it in our housing policy. But what the lobbying effort to have this passed is not necessarily helping home ownership. It's just helping developers be able to provide potentially homes or condos or townhomes. But it also could benefit them if they were just building an apartment. Isn't that correct? I think that, Anna, that would be for you. Or is it only the proposed, Mr. Kingston, maybe you can answer that. Would the proposed only involve home occupied ownership, or would it involve all development?
You have to do it for all. You can't specify one
right
or the other. But the point is, we know what we're getting right now, so we know it'll move in the needle. It'll change the mix of the product.
And it will also help apartments, not, I mean, just developers without any home. So it's not just geared at home occupied units. It's geared at all units.
Yep, except please, that we please, already know what's going on.
Okay.
You speak in a second. Thank you.
Okay. I think we should make a motion just to, I'd like to make a motion to take this out of the lobbying effort, and because I think there's a lot of confusion around it, and I don't think it is necessarily, we've been proven that it's going to provide what we're looking at doing. So.
Okay.
I don't know if that's just amendment to the motion.
Well, it's a new motion. Yeah, it's an amendment to
I'd have to ask the one that made it.
A friendly, you want to make it a friendly amendment?
A friendly amendment.
Okay. Who was your second? Yes, he accepted. Who was your second?
Councilmember Callahan.
It was second. Okay. Do you accept it as well? Okay. So that's the motion on the floor at this time. Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Well, I was going to just question the opportunity to move to separate. So I was going to basically reflect what Councilwoman Gates has just mentioned. So.
Okay. Thank you. Let's do first rounds and then we'll come back. Ms. McGee.
Just a quick question. I've been in thousands of multifamily units, and I don't know if I've ever seen a owner-occupied multifamily. Does that exist in this city?
Yeah, if it's condos. It's condos.
Townhome is a different definition under our code.
I thought you said condos.
Condo units are different. I've never seen a multifamily, which is three or more dwelling units on a lot, that's owner-occupied. Am I wrong?
Yes, sir. We have several condominium buildings within the city. We have even some more traditional multifamily-style developments that have been sold out in a condominium fashion. So we have...
So you have somebody lives in one, owns it, and then has several other next to them that are classified as
right. Typically, and probably the attorneys here could answer this better than me, but typically in a condominium regime, you own a percentage, if you will, of the real estate, the base real estate, and you own your unit. So that would be multifamily.
Well, you only become multifamily once you have three or more on a lot.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Griggs.
Thank you, Mayor. And I just want to clarify something with this. If Bernadette could come up. That in January of 2016, the City Council adopted a statement preferring and recognizing the importance of owner-occupied housing throughout the City of Dallas.
It does have that statement in there.
That statement says the city recognizes that ownership builds wealth, stabilizes neighborhoods, and provides opportunities for greater housing choices. Therefore, the City of Dallas will invest in creating ownership housing in all areas of Dallas. So that portion of our housing policy was adopted by the full council in January of 2016.
I stand corrected. It depends on how you interpret that, but yes, you're correct.
Okay, that's the time we passed it, just so everyone remembers, that's what we were doing, recognizing the importance of home ownership, whether it's condos or single families, and we took that element of our housing policy out of order and passed it before the entire policy, since it was so important to this council. So just wanted to clarify that and also say I agree with Mr. Kingston on this. I think he's absolutely correct on this and moving forward with this change of the state. I think it would be a great help to getting us more owner-occupied multifamily, and particularly condos in downtown and in uptown. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. May I address Mr. Kingston?
Please.
Philip, I was one of those that had asked a question because I didn't understand it, you know, when it originally came up. So from the folks that you've talked to, you know, at a state level that you think can sponsor, do you think they recognize that there's kind of a donut hole of, in other cities, of, hey, we're not getting the kind of development we want because of what you mentioned as far as, you know, the inability to get financing because of the 5-year versus 10-year?
Yeah, they're hearing from the same developer. I mean, this is one of those issues where the development community is trying to do the right thing by the city. They've seen, I mean, they, you know, these people come to the housing committee meetings and they read what we write. And they saw that owner-occupied thing and they said, hey, you know what the biggest problem is that we get sued 10 years down the road and it scares off the financing sources. So, I mean, this, you know, I'm a lawyer. I actually like for people to be able to sue each other. So this is a little bit against interest, but this is something that the people who build the housing that we need in this city have asked me for. So that's the only reason it's here before you.
Sure. And thank you for that. I think, you know, originally, you know, as an insurance agent in me, I, you know, kind of antithetical as well, you know, where it's like I want to make sure that we can sue, you know, responsible parties. I think from a practical standpoint, you know, I think in 12 years I've had 3 cases, and it's mainly with HOAs, you know, where the minute the HOA wasn't owned by the ownership group, all of a sudden the roof started leaking. So I haven't ever had a case that I know of where, you know, 9 years down the road we see a building defect. So I think I can absolutely support you on this for the goal of, hey, if it helps open up the credit markets to get, you know, ownership, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And that's why I thank you for your answer about kind of what the pulse is at the state level. I just want to make sure that this wasn't unique to Dallas, but it was unique to the state. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston, we'll come back.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to address a couple of things that Mr. Kleinman had raised. The state 10 years ago preempted 100% rule on condos, so nobody can stop a redevelopment of a condo because one owner objects. Even if the condo association's bylaws say that it takes 100%, state law has preempted that, which is the only reason you're seeing some of these condo redevelopment things. Not all the people in the Transwestern deal behind the pink wall agreed. Not all the people on the Katy Trail at Carlisle agreed. In fact, they came down here last week or two weeks ago to tell you exactly how much they're upset about that idea. And my point about trying to convert was the wrong word. And that you've raised that very clearly, Mr. Kleinman. What we're trying to do is simply on new construction projects. We're just trying to get a few more owner-occupied projects going. And this is just the one sort of barrier that the city has any hope of helping if we can get the legislature to go along with us. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson.
Thank you. I really like Mr. Kingston's goal here to have more owner-occupied properties, even if they're multifamily. But is there any way to separate out rental multifamily from owner-occupied related to what Mr. Kingston is proposing with this statute of repose, because multifamily developers sure do not need any more help creating rental multifamily. Thousands of units are springing up everywhere. They surely do not need any more help. But I like his goal about making some of that multifamily owner-occupied. Can we separate that out anyway? To separate out rental multifamily from owner-occupied multifamily as the developers are coming in to build it?
We can do whatever you want.
Well,
I mean,
is it practical to say, do we have any ability to say that? To separate
at the legislature.
Yeah, as this bill, this type of legislation moves forward.
It would depend on how the bill is drafted. The bill would need to be drafted to specify that.
Well, I'd certainly be in favor of this if there was some way to separate out developers coming in purely wanting to build more rental multifamily from those who are interested in having owner-occupied multifamily. If we were to hold off on adding this to the legislative program today, how much time would we have if we decided we wanted to add it later? I mean, does it have to be done as part of our program today, or is there ability to...
You could, if you wanted to research this further and discuss it at a later date...
Please, get next to the mic.
You could certainly bring this back at a later time. I mean, you know, the legislative session starts in January. We need to go ahead and start identifying sponsors for all the items that are in this, but if you wanted to discuss it further and bring it back, we could certainly pursue it later. But you don't want to get too much past the first of the year, obviously, because...
Certainly didn't mean holding off that long on it, but I was thinking that Mr. Kingston is already seeking sponsors and having some success. I don't want to harm his ability to do that if indeed we can separate out the two types of multifamily. So we could add it. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Well, excuse me. Just following along, I believe it would be in our best interest to continue to separate this item and to give all of us an opportunity to give a little bit more in-depth research. I would be interested in hearing from those developers who develop in the southern sector, because I haven't heard from any of them asking that they be relieved from accountability. And I believe in layman's term, is that what we're asking, is to release these developers from accountability, reduce from 10 years to 5 years their accountability?
It reduces the window of time that someone could bring a lawsuit against them for defective construction.
So there may be something that comes up over time, whether it was the use of certain materials, actual build site, and so it gives that occupant an opportunity to come back. And I don't want us to support a policy that possibly could bring our constituents on the short end of the stick. We've seen some of what our quick decisions have led to today, and so as it relates to affordable housing and lack of and some other conversations, so I believe we need to be very careful as we move forward. So I would continue to ask all of us, and many times I hear us talk about what we did in committee and how we supported, but we have to let the public know all of us are not on the same committee, and we don't often follow all of the committees. So conversations take place in various committees, and that we're not all privy to the discussion. But in this case, I believe we need to take time, and I will support the separation of this item, possibly bringing it back upon further investigation, research, dialogue with some of our constituents who perhaps are developers and have an interest. But I believe as a constituent voice right now, I would rather support the constituents, not disrespecting the developers, but I've not heard any of them ask us to relieve them from accountability. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Young.
Thank you. Along the same lines, in a day and time where I think the comment was made that 25 multifamily projects are going on in the city right now, we have an issue with them not including affordable housing. And this appears to be, the more conversation I've heard, something that is developer-friendly, not necessarily people-friendly. And so I will be supporting Councilwoman Gates' motion, or friendly amendment to the motion, to not include this in the package. And a comment was made that I guess legislators are hearing from the same developer. And so I guess my question would be, who is this developer that this is being crafted for, because I thought we were for the people. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Callahan, you haven't spoken.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I've listened with interest with the discussion, and I'm not sure how this affects, you know, the warranty system. You know, historically we've had the homeowner's warranty program, which was typically 10 years, so it seems to be incongruent to say that we want to relieve them from responsibility when traditionally a warranty has been in effect for about 10 years. So I don't know if Mr. Kingston would care to discuss that and see how that those two might align, because I want to make sure that builders are building a quality product and they'll stand on that, make sure the foundation is protected, and adequate rebar, concrete, as far as building, all that. We've had a rash of that back in, you know, during the building boom times of the not only early 80s, but also, you know, the early 2000s and so forth. And I really don't want to go back to those days where we have just a lot of really bad product out there that has to be eventually bulldozed because builders would not stand behind their product. So I would appreciate if Mr. Kingston would consider a discussion of that. I think that would be an important matter. And I think there's too many unopened questions here. I think Ms. Young and also Ms. Arnold both have raised issues, and even others, you know, Ms. Grayson, Ms. Gates. And I think we need to look at this a little bit longer and a little bit harder. And I too, would love to see the separation, single-family home ownership, multifamily ownership, as well as multifamily rentals, because I really want to promote single-family home ownership in my district. And I think that's really what Dallas needs to bring in more disposable income. But I also understand that, you know, the new rage is kind of multifamily ownership, condos, townhouses, patio homes, et cetera. And that I'm not opposed to that, but I certainly don't want to be on record as, hey, let's go get some more rental housing units and then relieve builders' responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple things. Philip, thank you for clarifying on the older stock that doesn't take 100%. That's important. If we want to encourage home ownership, we probably need to look to our own policies with regards to our treatment of multifamily, because we do not treat multifamily any distinction between owner-occupied or rental. And I definitely would be concerned that if we would like to do, as Ms. Grayson suggests, have a legislative item that makes that distinction, we have to do that in our own ordinances as well somehow. So that if there is that distinction at the ledge, then when it comes back to us, if a developer says, I'm building this as to be owner-occupied versus rental, we have some way to address that in the city. So before we get too far in front of ourselves with regards to the state, we need to look and see if our own city policies with regards to that are appropriate. Because we do not make that distinction, I know a lot of times developers build stuff and the neighbors want to know, is this going to be owner-occupied or is this going to be rental? And the developer says they can't speak to that, or the city doesn't look to that. And I do think owner-occupied is probably preferred to rental units when a multifamily unit goes up. So not to uncan more worms around here. But we need to, let's be sure we're asking for policies or legislation in Austin that indeed we can comply with when it gets back to Dallas. So I would prefer that we move forward with the main legislative agenda as amended by Ms. Gates, and then maybe do a little more research, and we can certainly add it into the legislative agenda between now and the ledge. The other thing we can do is, rather than being a sponsor of a bill, if a bill like this comes forward, we can certainly be supportive if indeed the council wants us to support somebody else's bill. So at this point, I think we ought to just move forward with the main legislative agenda, and it sounds like there's some questions to be answered on this particular statute. Oh, incidentally, I did want to mention that I know there are folks in the industry that may be interested in this, but I have typically I do get some correspondence from the Real Estate Council and from the Apartment Association of Greater Dallas on many of the legislative issues that we face, and I have not had any commentary on this particular issue from either of those organizations. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
I just want to say briefly, you know, I think that's absolutely a smart point that we should, you know, look at things at our level, but this is our window to be able to talk to the state. And I think it's a smart idea. I don't think there's any downside to this. If our stated goal is we want more home ownership, and whether it's development community or the banking community, you know, thinks that, hey, listen, if we just tweak what's not a great law now that's affecting other cities, and if we just make it smarter, then we can actually have a chance to increase this. I just don't see what the downside to this is. You know, when it gets to a state level, if when their lawyers look at it, when their legislators look at it, and when all the different lobbying groups come around pro and con, if there's a problem with this, they don't have to write a law. I just don't. I think Mr. Kingston's point is pretty sound that, hey, if there's a gap in the marketplace, then we should say as a city, we can't build more multifamily ownership properties if we don't have a reduction in the law that makes that more feasible. So I'm going to support Mr. Kingston on this because I get the concerns, but I appreciate the effort of trying to make sure that we're getting folks into homes. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson.
If the council votes to hold this, could we hold it to a date certain so that we know that we're going to address it? So often what we do is we say we'll bring it back and then 20 other things come in front of us and we get distracted and it gets pushed. Can we put a date certain on it, the maker of the motion or the friendly amendment or the acceptor of the motion and the seconder? And I mean,
I'm so sorry, Ms. Grayson. I was not listening.
Okay, what I was boo-hoo. Okay.
I was listening to my colleague over
there. Let me just cut let me cut the chase. I think what Ms. Grayson's asking is, could your motion be that we would reconsider this item at a date?
So that it's not just lingering
sure.
out there, because
sure.
I do think that Mr. Kingston has a good point, and I would certainly support it if there was some way to write the legislation to differentiate between renter multifamily and owner-occupied multifamily, and then give us time to do what Mr. Kleinman suggested and maybe look at our own language here at the city. But I'd like a date certain because I don't want this to just hang out there, because there's some merit to this,
okay.
I think.
Yes. So, let's see. November 9th. Is that
okay.
That would be our next council meeting, correct?
That's pretty quick. Maybe we only have one council meeting in November, I think, and one in December.
Right. Yeah. So that way we can pass the entire agenda and have this item come back to us. For example.
December 14th would be the meeting,
Briefing meeting. It's a briefing meeting.
No, December 14th is not. It's a council, but we could do it on a briefing agenda.
We could do it on a
December
briefing
7th.
Day
yeah.
as an
you
action
could do
item.
You could do it then.
A briefing and an action item.
Sure.
Because I'd hate to wait till the middle of December. That's getting awfully close to the start of the legislative session.
As far as having some additional time to get it to a committee or whatever.
All right, well, I don't think we need that as a motion. I think we'll just take that action up, okay? Yeah.
Staff direction.
To staff direction to bring that on the 7th. Okay.
Right. Just sooner rather than later.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll do that. With that, anything else, Ms. Grayson?
No.
Okay. Thank you. With that, all in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried. So we'll everything else is moved ahead. We'll take that issue and we'll talk about it on the 7th. Thank you.
Agenda item number 38 is authorize the third amendment to the Performing Arts Center use agreement with Dallas Center for the Performing Arts Foundation, Inc. to increase annual support from $2,500,000 to $4 million to provide promotion and support of nonprofit arts and cultural organizations. Councilmember Kingston, pull the item.
Thank you. Ms. Alonzo, motion approved. And we have a second discussion. Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? One opposed. A motion is carried. Thank you. Next item.
For agenda item 47, there are no board and commission appointments today. Agenda item 48 is consideration of two alternative ordinances amending Chapter 20A, Fair Housing, of the Dallas City Code to either, number one, prohibit discrimination in housing on the basis of source of income, or number two, prohibit discrimination in housing on the basis of source of income, except as prohibited by state law. We do have four registered speakers on this item, and they are Mike Kaprowski, Demetra McCain, Nicole Rolfe, Bernestine Williams, and Jamaica Neville. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice a timer at the podium. When your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. You should stay to the topic as well as address your comments to Mayor Rawlings. Mike Kaprowski.
Good morning, council members. My name is Mike Kaprowski. Here speaking as a citizen, not in an official capacity. Would like to thank the Housing Committee for developing promising proposals. Approving source of income non-discrimination would send a strong signal that Dallas is committed to furthering fair housing and integration, and that it's strong enough to tackle the discrimination which inhibits those goals. It would set an early step for future progress. The problem is real. Landlords in high opportunity areas consistently refuse voucher holders, even when the voucher covers the asked rent. It's a national problem. Voucher discrimination plays a role in keeping low-income families and neighborhoods mired in concentrated poverty, which research clearly shows leads to compounded inequality and terrible economic mobility. Consequences are particularly insidious for children. By contrast, mountains of research show that diverse neighborhoods enhance mobility and spur economic growth. Studies find dramatic improvements in life trajectories for voucher holders that are able to move to better neighborhoods, particularly for kids. Inclusionary housing policies in and of themselves have been shown to accelerate achievement for poor students. Many states and cities have passed source of income non-discrimination with solid outcomes and a better disbursement of low-income families across the city. But at its most human level, this is about families on the lowest ends of the poverty spectrum, our most vulnerable citizens, many of whom are disabled, going to a landlord and inquiring, "I'd like to live here. It'd be a better life for me and my kids. I can afford the asked rent with my voucher. You have units available. It's a stable, lawful source of income, and I meet all of the other qualifications of tenancy." And the landlord legally says no. Imagine what that does to a person's self-worth. Imagine what it does to a family's humanity. These aren't isolated anecdotes. It's a practice in high opportunity areas. And you have the ability to do something about it today by passing an ordinance. I believe that those who take a stand against discrimination end on the right side of history. 9 out of 10 voucher holders are low-income people of color seeking opportunity like we all do. Voucher discrimination has a disproportionate impact, almost pretty much an exclusive impact, on low-income people of color. And while the practice may appear neutral to some, regardless of intent, it manifests as a form of discrimination as plain as day. It'll require courage. It's about the kind of city we want to live in. And it's about whether we'll go far enough to meaningfully address our past mistakes, which have contributed to a very segregated city. If we don't stand firm against different forms of discrimination, if we don't challenge it wherever we find it, if we don't force the issue, then nothing changes. And I think that that's the lesson of history. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Demetra McCain, Nicole Rolfe, Bernstein Williams, and Jamika Neville will follow.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Morning.
I'm Demetria McCain, president of the Inclusive Communities Project. I believe the Inclusive Communities Project made clear in its presentation to the Housing Committee back in April where it stands on this issue, but I will reiterate that we do believe that the City Council here of Dallas should, in fact, pass a source of income protection ordinance. A lot has been discussed at the briefing last week that you had. Some people raised issues about state law. In addition to saying that this council should pass a source of income protection type of ordinance, Dallas is a leader. Dallas is a leader in the state. As the leader that Dallas is, if council has an issue with what's going on in the state, it would be wonderful to see this issue come up for repeal in Dallas to seek repeal of anything that the council believes might be in its way on a state level. My colleague, we speak more directly on our personal experiences with housing choice voucher holders who are seeking housing. But I just want you to know that states like California, Connecticut, D.C., Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, and Wisconsin actually have state-level sources of income protection. So we're sitting in the state that says what it says, but Dallas could be a leader to deal with that issue, and we can start today by the city of Dallas passing a source of income protection ordinance so that voucher holders are no longer discriminated against. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Nicole Rowe. Ms. Rolfe will be followed by Bernstein Williams and Jamika Neville.
Good morning, Mayor Rollins and City Council members. My name is Nicole Rolfe, and I am the director at the Inclusive Communities Projects located at 3301 Elm Street, Dallas, Texas, 75226. As you see, my colleagues and I, we're on the front lines. We're working daily to help our families locate housing, and we're running against the wall. We're facing major barriers as we help our families locate housing in well-resourced areas. The problems and the barriers that it's causing for our families are things such as they're losing their vouchers, they're becoming homeless, as we've heard a lot about in the last several months. They're facing many barriers. Just yesterday, I had a client in our office, and she was talking to me about how she lost her housing assistance because she couldn't find housing in the allotted amount of time. And due to losing her housing assistance, she became homeless. And as a result of her becoming homeless, she lost her children to foster care. So for these reasons and many more, I ask that you vote to ban voucher discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Bernstein Williams. Ms. Williams is not present. Jamika Neville. Ms. Neville? Not present. Mr. Mayor, that concludes the registered speakers.
Thank you. Entertain a motion, Mr. Griggs.
After consideration of both ordinances, I move to take no further action on Ordinance 2 and to approve Ordinance 1.
A motion and a second. Discussion. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We've had discussion of this extensively. We have a state government that is misguided on this deal. We have thousands of Dallasites who right now are holding on to vouchers that expire in 90 days, and they have whatever level of anxiety that creates in a family. I'm fortunate not to have ever experienced it, about where will I be able to live? My voucher expires. We have a very sophisticated class of landlords in town, and they won't take these things. Our quickest win on this housing policy to get people into housing that allows them to do all the things that we keep talking about over and over again, have their kids in the same school from year to year, have a stable commute to a job that hopefully continues to exist for them, to be able to start being involved in a community, to be able to have their voice heard at City Hall. All of those things sort of depend on having some idea of where you're going to go home to sleep at night. And this is how we do it. We know, as the speakers told us, that in Demetrius told us that other states have this at a state level. We know that landlords can deal with this. We know this isn't a bridge too far or us applying a regulation to an industry where we don't understand the effect of what we're doing. We know exactly how this will work because we've seen it in other places. And we need to be brave. We need to not lose our guts on this deal. You can't look at these voucher holders and tell them, hey, we had a chance, but we lost our guts because some people in Austin told us they might not appreciate what we're doing. They're not here. I don't see any of them here. They don't even listen to these meetings. I got to tell you, I've talked to many of them. They have no idea what's going on here. Mike Kaprowski knows what's going on here. Mike Kaprowski is trying to get the school district to reorient itself so that we wind up with mixed-income schools. This is our chance to help us get mixed-income neighborhoods. The same goals he's trying to vindicate on the educational level also work on all the social levels. When you live in a mixed-income neighborhood, the neighborhood simply does better. All of the people in the neighborhood do better. And that's really what the That's what the Supreme Court's trying to tell us. I think that's what slowly HUD is trying to tell us, is that we've all got to learn to live together somehow. And this is a really good opportunity for us to do this. I can't be more proud of the job that Mr. Griggs has done on this housing policy, and this is going to be maybe the easiest, quickest, and most dynamic way to get thousands of people into housing. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. It's ironic that a number of my colleagues were concerned about development and building, you know, more housing units, particularly multifamily units. And I just really want to go on record that this, folks, is really will potentially kill the home building, apartment building business in Dallas. I think it will discourage responsible apartment investors and owners to basically just simply skip Dallas. This isn't being done anywhere that I know of in Texas. Even Austin passed on this. As Mr. Kleinman always loves to say, the People's Republic of Austin. You know, the most liberal city in Texas, they're not for it. Both houses in Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, nobody will support that on Capitol Hill to make this mandatory. I think it's extremely dangerous, and I really implore, I want you colleagues to really, really, really stop and think about this, what you're doing. It really runs counter to really a free, democratic, fair, and just society. It should be voluntary. It should be volitional. In terms of veterans housing, you know, we might be able to do that, but I don't think this could even pass a court challenge, really. Honestly, I'm not sure that we could get past that. But it also runs counter, again, to Senate Bill 267 that was passed just the last legislative session, which really prohibits such ordinances like this. Now, while Dallas is obligated, you know, by its agreement with HUD to consider a source of income ordinance, it's not required to pass one, folks. We're not required to pass this. And again, I'm always going to be about choice, and I want to give you a case history with the balance of my time. I've been in the business 37 going on 38 years. I've been on every side of the real estate business, residential, commercial, home building, management of apartments, management of houses, management of buildings, the whole thing. And I've dealt with Section 8. I've had good times. I've had bad times. But when you're talking about a sizable number of units enforcing ownership to do this, there is a great lag. There's a great delay in getting your money. You may shoot for July the 1st, but now we have the city inspection program that was passed. So you got to get it inspected before somebody can actually rent it. And then once you do rent it, you've got to really go through two leases. You've got to create a lease with them yourself, and then you got to get the housing authority lease, you know, the Section 8 things, to be able to get your voucher. Then you're going to wait anywhere from 60 to maybe 120 days to get paid. Now, folks, these apartments and these even homes, these are investments. There's mortgages to be paid. There's property tax to be paid. There's insurance to be paid. There's all kind of bills to be paid. The yard's got to get mowed until such time that a tenant moves in a single-family home, let's say, and they're responsible, the tenants, you know, to mow their own yard. So there could be utilities that need to be left on in the owner's name. You know, that's got to be paid until the tenant transfers those because, again, you got to get the City of Dallas inspection. This is like pouring gasoline on a fire. Of anything since I've been here, in 3.5 years, this is probably the most dangerous thing that this city could do as far as shutting down really responsible investment. I don't know of anybody for it. The builders are not for it. The apartment people are not for it. The real estate community is not for it. Austin's not for it. No other city in Texas is for it. Being bold and being a leader, going out and doing this, it's never been done, and there's a reason it hasn't been done. This is about freedom. This is about fairness. This is about, hey, I put my money out there. I got the mortgage, and I'm going out to lease the building. I ought to be able to lease it to who I want to. Obviously, there's fair housing concerns and laws and so forth, and if there's 4% and 9% tax credits, we get all that stuff. But to come back and just force people to do this, and I'm not saying if you want to do it, I've done it myself. Again, I've had good luck, and I've had bad luck. But even in the best of circumstances, I've had to wait and there's a loss of rent. Do you understand that? Yeah. Several people even on this council, you know, they lease property out. So you've got to, again, wait on your money. You got a mortgage payment stacking up. You've got all these challenges, all these bills to pay, and then you don't have any money coming in. And then if you've got multiple units, that's just going to be exacerbated. So I really want everyone to hit the timeout button and really look into themselves. Not because this is a feel-good, hey, man, Dallas, let's check the box. Look what we did. We made America great today in Dallas by doing this. Don't do it. I ask you not to do it. I ask you to look at it, come up with an alternative, something that's better. I liked Mr. Kingston's idea that he promulgated a few weeks ago about why don't we go out and incentivize these people? If we buy down mortgages, we can buy the rent down. We can also give owners that want to do this, you know, give them some kind of an incentive to go out and do it. That way it can kind of fill the gap, you know, when they're not receiving their mortgage payment, I'm sorry, they're not receiving the rental payment, this will really help them. It will supplement the income. But when you have to have X dollars accumulated from the rents to pay all of those property taxes, insurance, bills, et cetera, and then you lose a couple of months' rent because you're waiting on your voucher, it's just not good business. And to make them do it, again, volitional, if they want to do it, I'm all for it. If we want to incentivize them to do it, great. Just don't make it mandatory. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The proposal that's in front of you is going to make you feel good that you're going to be able to vote for something that's going to have a solution to find people homes, but the reality is it's not. It's going to go against state law, and it's going to be tied up in courts, and people are going to stand there with their vouchers and still not have homes. So if you want to figure out a solution, we need to look at the problems that are associated with the vouchers in the first place. The vouchers are not, they're not meeting what the right now there's not a big supply because we're 96% leased in the city of Dallas, and the rents are rising, and the vouchers aren't equal to those. The vouchers are determined by zip codes, and that's the ceiling for it, and the rents are rising a lot faster, and the vouchers aren't matching the amount that's needed to match market. And we don't have the units available. So, and we just, you know, we're going to try to force something that's not going to work, and we're still going to have a homeless problem, and we're still going to have an affordable problem. Take example from what Austin did. I mean, they took this policy back because it was against state law, and then they looked at their veterans and figured out, hey, we've got X number of veterans who need units, how many units do they need, and how can we make that program work? Those are the kind of things we need to be doing. We're not even having those conversations with what's available and who's standing there. We haven't figured out what that number is, what that need is, and then how to meet that need, how to either figure out gap financing or incentives or something. But just to mandate something that's going to get tied up in lawsuits is not helping the people. It's living in a fantasy land. And to have these promises that, hey, we can do this, and you guys are going to have homes, and your clients are going to have homes, is a lie. And it's not being part of the solution. We've got to work with HUD to figure it out and figure out why their programs that they put in place are not working and why people aren't finding homes. That's what we need to be working on. Creating something like this and then having people say, I'm being able to have a complaint that because of I was discriminated, a source of income is just going to flood our housing department with very difficult we're not going to be able to say why were they really discriminated against. We need to roll up our sleeves and figure out, and I'm not getting that from the housing committee. I'm getting let's just mandate things and just hope it works. Well, that's fantasy. We've got to come up with solutions that are going to be supported, that are going to end up resulting in finding homes. We can't just mandate and hope it works. And that's all I'm hearing from this council. And it may make you feel good and may make you think you're part of a solution, but you're not going to be part of a solution. and we're not, it's not going to create just a flood of units available. So let's work on doing that and get away from these mandates that are going to be tied up in courts, and we're not going to find a solution.
Thank you, Mr. Griggs.
Thank you, Mayor. This is about undeniable patterns of inequality in our city that exist. The city of Dallas has recognized them. The state has recognized them at the TDHCA. The federal government and HUD have recognized them. And Dallas is not alone in these patterns of inequality. They exist in many of our urban cities. This is about giving people choice to live closer to jobs, to live closer to high-quality schools, to live closer to public transportation. Choices that don't exist right now. And without these choices, too often, people's futures are determined by which zip code they're in. And that is not right. There are many times here at the Dallas City Council where we decide how much litigation risk do we want to take? Is this something that we'll go to the mat for? Some of us have seen that on gas drilling. Others have seen it on conventions that come to the city of Dallas. But I would certainly hope this is one that we can all get around and support. Where people live, their access to jobs, high-quality schools, and public transportation is so fundamental to determining people's opportunities and their success, that we cannot sit around anymore and allow people to be stuck in a situation, individuals, families, children, when they hold a voucher, which is a legal source of income, that will get paid, and they're denied the right to live in a part of town near a job, near a high-quality school, and near public transportation, solely because of the source of income. It is time, as a city, that we move beyond that. This is one of the big issues facing the city of Dallas. We all know the statistics on poverty here. We have a huge amount of poverty in this city of Dallas. And today we can take a step towards making that better. This is not going to be a silver bullet. This is not going to end the work of the Housing Committee. This is not going to end the work of the Dallas City Council on housing, on poverty, on other issues. This is one part of a much longer plan, much bigger plan that we're all working on. But this is an important part of it. We have to more evenly distribute our resources, and particularly with these housing vouchers that end up being used too often, too many times in the city of Dallas, not throughout the city of Dallas, but just in certain parts of town. We have to open up doors for people. That is what this is about. The housing voucher needs to be a key, and it needs to be a key for every apartment in the city of Dallas that can unlock a door for a family to live in any apartment when the only barrier to them not living in that apartment is this housing voucher. And if we make these housing vouchers a key, and if they can unlock any door, then people will live closer to schools. They will give their children a greater opportunity. They will live closer to the public transportation they need. They will live closer to jobs. They will not have these commutes of hours on a failed DART system. They will not have to go to a school that they don't want to send their children to. They will not have the burden of driving so much because they can live closer to public transportation. This today is about what we think of housing choice vouchers. Are, in fact, these a key to any door in the city of Dallas to help people make a better life, a better future for themselves and their children? Or is it, in fact, something that's going to be difficult to use and you're going to be stuck in one part of town and not be able to move forward? That's what today's vote's about. And so I would implore all of you to know that there are many people that support this. We've heard from them. Some of them are here today. That this can be a key to the future for them. And know that this is the city of Dallas. Developers are going to continue to make money. They're going to do just fine, the development community and the apartment community. But today we have to think of those people that need an opportunity for the jobs, the schools, the public transportation. We have to undo these patterns of inequality in the city of Dallas and introduce choice for everyone and give them that key to choice. So I'd encourage all of you to vote yes on this today. And that this is something that if we do get sued over, to me, this is why we're here. We're here on the tough calls on people's futures, on the policies of the city of Dallas. And this is something to me that's worth to litigate over. This is one of the single biggest issues affecting not only the city of Dallas, but other large urban areas around the country, is giving people a future and giving them that key to open any door in the city of Dallas and open it up and move their family in and get to the schools, get to the jobs, get to the public transportation, and have a better future. And that's what today's vote's about. So I encourage you all to vote yes. Thank you.
Mr. Clayton.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You know, laws evolve. You know, we hear terms about fairness and individual freedoms and business owners can do what they want. We have laws in this state. Last time I checked, 50 years ago, we gave the freedom of individual business owners to not allow certain types of people to use their bathrooms or their facilities because they didn't look like the person who owned the business. But we evolved past that. They don't even call Section 8 vouchers Section 8 vouchers anymore because of the connotation and the inherent bias that's in that. If an apartment owner, you know, saw somebody who was single and 24 and blonde and white come into their apartment and they knew they'd have guaranteed rent but they'd have to wait 60 days for it, they'd rent that every day of the week. But when that family is Hispanic or black and has young kids, well, then they're worried that they're going to trash their apartment. That's what this is about. I get, and Ms. Gates, thank you for your comment about trying to fix, you know, some of the problems with HUD. There are issues, and there are things that we can address, but we do need to take stands when it's the right thing. And if we get legislated against, great. Because the state knows this is wrong, but they carve out little, you know, patterns in there for veterans, because then they can say, well, see, we love our military, but we hate our minorities. That's okay. But if we're not willing to take a stand on this, what are we willing to take a stand for? We go against the advice of our legal counsel and get into a lawsuit immediately because we don't like the moral sensibilities of what comes to our convention center, but we won't stand up for the least of our citizens. Poor people do not have lobbyists. They have advocates. And thank you guys for being here today. But we are also the advocates for our communities. Poor, rich, black, white, purple. But this is something worth voting for. So I'm going to be in support of this today, and I would encourage you to do so as well. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. Yet again, I'm trying to reconcile what our own policies are with what the state has mandated. One of the fortunate freedoms that we have with regards to local control in the city of Dallas is that if the state has not spoken, we're allowed to make ordinances and do as we please. In this case, the state has spoken. Regardless of whether we agree with the state or not, the fact of the matter is that there's a state law preventing us from enforcing this ordinance. I'm getting verification, but ironically, the folks that are pushing for this have not asked us to add to our legislative agenda the opportunity to overturn that state law. Mr. Castor, do you want to speak to that question? Other than, although it would definitely qualify under our local control coverage, but do we have specific things in our agenda or requests in our agenda to overturn this?
Councilman,
statute?
I think the request was submitted.
Okay.
Actually, it was not put in pending what the council may or may not do today, but okay. I think it would be very well within the means of power of this body to make a motion to amend the legislative agenda, if you so desire, to go down and undo that statute in Austin.
Okay, great, thank you. Then, so I guess depending on the outcome of this vote, we'll modify the legislative agenda appropriately. One thing I do want to ask staff with regards to this, the does the housing choice voucher program zip code tables. And while staff is coming up here, I do want to thank Ms. McCain for meeting with me to explain the voucher program and how it works. I would encourage anybody, whatever side of this you're on, to meet with some of those folks just to hear how these programs work. But I do have some questions, in particular about these zip code tables that show. So I guess the first question, go ahead and introduce yourself and kind of a series.
Beverly Davis with Fair Housing.
Thank you, Beverly. So I notice on this table it shows by zip code an amount that the voucher will pay up to. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then what amount does the person applying for the apartment pay?
The issuing housing authority will calculate a portion of the rent not to exceed 30% of the income of the person.
Okay, so I'm looking at like a 75229 area, which is up here in North Dallas. I think it's in. Okay, I want to talk about your district. It's in all our districts, right? And so there, for example, it shows a two-bedroom apartment, $920 a month is the maximum amount that between 30% of your income and the voucher will pay for. And the voucher will cover up to that amount, which is great for anything that's at that or less. What happens if the market rate in a particular apartment complex is over that $920 for a two-bedroom?
The issuing housing authority has the ability to go up to 110%.
Okay.
The zip code.
So
yes.
Let's say it's above 110%, which would be, you know, $1,020 or something like that.
So in that case, if the market rate of that particular complex was above what that zip code allows, then they would not be able to use their voucher at that location.
So if they agreed to use their voucher and then pay the difference between the 110% and what the market was, what happens to them in the voucher program?
They cannot pay the difference because they would be exceeding their portion of the rent if they're paying above.
What if they're found to be paying the difference?
Then they could be considered not eligible for the program anymore and have their voucher terminated.
Right. So actually this program presents quite a quandary for voucher holders, which is they could actually be at risk of losing their voucher if they want to move into these areas where the rents are higher than the voucher allows for. Is that correct?
Well, what normally happens is that there's a range of different places that they will look at. There will be some that will be in that range, and there will be some that are not in that range. But in a tight market as it is now, that has been a challenge. And some zip codes people finding.
So here's where I find the kind of juxtaposition. If we are going to require landlords to accept vouchers, but their rents are higher than 110% of this table, does that, first of all, open up more units in those areas?
No. The owners or property managers, there's nothing in the ordinance that requires them to take vouchers if it's below what their rent is, what they're charging for rent.
Right. So the property owners can get full recovery of their market rent.
Yes.
But then the voucher owners actually risk losing the voucher if they engage into a lease that exceeds the differential.
Yes.
So I guess thank you very much for that clarification, and it is complex. My concern is that I don't think that this is going to bring more affordable units into the city, available into the city of Dallas, because if you compare these tables, and I can distribute these to everybody, look in your own zip codes, they're not nearly up to par, and I don't know how frequently these are changed in Dallas Housing Authority, what the basis of that is. Maybe you can,
annually.
Yeah. Annually,
adjusted,
right. So, and if I look at even some of the areas in my district, where I have what I call market rate low income housing, meaning there's no outside support for it, even those rates where I have single bedrooms in that Kit Mayhem area, they're higher than this table to live there. And those are people that actually need the help. We have a lack of housing in Dallas in general, and trying to put a rent control component into that could actually have adverse effects I don't think we're prepared for. So I would argue two things. One is, it's not clear to me that requiring vouchers really works, but secondly, if it's not allowed by state law, I think our real approach needs to be see if we can't fix the state law before we start making policies that go against it. Thank you very much.
Ms. Young.
Thank you. I would support amending the legislative package to add just that. But today I stand with all of the speakers and all of the people that they represent, that they are working with in the field. As I think back in history to the year 1965 when Dr. Martin Luther King went to Chicago, and I think that led to the 1968 fair housing laws. And so here we are in 2016 where we several have agreed that perhaps the law that is on the books in the state is not one that we would be supportive of. One of my mentors always said, if you see a good fight, get in it. And I think today we have a good fight to get in the middle of. As we look at the discrimination that is going on across the city of Dallas, and as some have said, across this country, and we talk about being a world-class city. As I heard last night in a town hall meeting, many individuals talking about the poverty in Dallas and how do we call ourselves a world-class city and we have the childhood poverty that exists in this city. And how do we call ourselves a world-class city and we have this type of discrimination going on in our city? And so today I am supportive of the motion that is on the table. And some have questioned about potential lawsuit. And just a few months ago, several of us around this horseshoe, enough to move it forward, voted on to get us in another lawsuit. And so, and I was a part of that group that voted on that. But I think certainly today, even more so than that issue, that this is an issue to stand behind and stand up and fight for those in the community. And so it may not get us where we want to be tomorrow, after the day after this vote or the day of this vote, but certainly it begins the process to move us down the road to what we are trying to achieve. And that is complete fair housing in the city of Dallas. It is just beyond me that in the year 2016, when I think back in history, and I've had to fight all my life against the odds and continue to have to struggle in that by sheer nature of being born an African-American female. And so I understand the odds that many families face in this city today. It is not lost on me. And so I struggle with why we would not stand behind and support something that would help us move that needle forward for so many families of many different races, backgrounds, but particularly our working poor and our poor families in the city of Dallas who are discriminated on a day-to-day basis as they seek housing. At the town hall last night, we heard from a gentleman that spoke here last week at city council about going around the city and being turned away at every turn. And I can't imagine, as we heard from families today in West Dallas, I can't imagine what those families go through that are out there walking the pavement every day, day in, day out, working with advocates such as ICP, trying to find housing, and being turned around at every corner, and then trying to figure out other issues in life, their children's education, transportation, as we dealt with yesterday with DART, and so many other issues, feeding their kids and can't even get housing and decent housing at that. And so I will close the mic, but I certainly stand in support of the motion that is on the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
I think I'm on now. Am I on? All right, thank you. Just want to follow up on the comments and about selective posturing, positioning on laws that are actions that are protected by state law. I think if we continue just to go with everything that's written in code, many states would still see us in bondage as slaves. Somebody has to stand up and fight. And so there are times when you have to make that decision. I'm not saying we have to fight everything that's on the books, but when it becomes relevant to civil rights, then we have to do what's right. And it's always the right time to do what's the right thing at the right time. And so I'm not suggesting that we just act as if we have no respect at all for the Constitution. But the bottom line is we're talking about people. Now, I've heard, and I'll be brief today because I know many of you have heard me say the same thing around this table, this horseshoe, over and over about the need to fight for and put in place equity opportunities throughout this city. I've said before, it takes only 8 of us to do the right thing, 8 to be great. And then I hear others talk now about what we need to do to make sure everyone has an opportunity to do. What we need to do is to not just talk about it, but be about it. We continue to vote for housing patterns that enrich certain parts of the city. We continue to vote for economic development that only prospers in certain parts of the city. We continue to support those developers, builders, who only want to build in a certain part of the city. We keep rewarding them with incentives, abatements. So we've got to be about it and stop sitting around the horseshoe talking about it. One of my colleagues said today, just a few minutes ago, I'm not going to ever be ready. That was said to me. I'm always going to be ready. Ready for a fight. Any day, any time of the week when it comes to constituents. But I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired of hearing us talk about equity, talk about civil rights. And our actions are totally opposite. We're familiar with red lines around this horseshoe because we continue to support the redlining, the discrimination by zip codes. So we can talk all day long, but anytime anyone in this audience and my constituents who are listening, and I appreciate that because they're listening more and more and they're asking questions. And so when you hear comments around the horseshoe about who's not ready, and when you read the social media and you hear about Wiley Dallas talking about who's not ready, who's not knowledgeable, who's not doing what they're supposed to do, we have the facts here at the city of Dallas. That's what I surround myself with, facts, research. Staff can tell you that. And everything I talk about, I'm talking about economic development, housing patterns, I can pull the research to show it's not in the areas where we have the concentration of poverty. So when we keep talking about it, it sounds good for that, and we can post it on the Facebook that we talked about it. But until we get to the point where we see the actions, then everything we're doing here today is not. So I don't mind fighting. But Ms. Gates, you're right. We have to be more serious, and we have to take the opportunity to research and know it ourselves. The constituents don't realize that all of us don't go to all of the committees. Many times we have so much research laid before us on a Friday night, we depend on others. So many times we're not as prepped, and I'm going to speak for myself too. I make every effort to be the valedictorian of whatever it is I'm standing before when it comes here. But I need the support of the other council members, and there are 7 more of us. I'm number one who can help us move this fight so that the work that Mark Clayton is doing in his committee with poverty, we can really make a difference. Clayton, I appreciate everything you're doing to fight the fight, and sometimes I know it just becomes overwhelming because you're talking about poverty, and then you're pushing front forward, and we're going backwards. So we have a lot of work to do, and as I said, it's good to hear you all talk about it. But, hey, the proof is in the pudding. Let's see if we can't put some housing in the southern sector where it matters so that all these people that you talk about getting quality jobs and can go here and there, source of income, put it in the southern sector so we can see what's happening. put it in the areas of concentration of poverty so we can see what happens. We're dealing with not only this discrimination, just regular, everyday discrimination where I can't. Matter of fact, this is an assignment I'll give everybody. Sit at your house and see how many pizza places will come to your zip code beyond that red line in the southern sector. See how many, Swans that would come over, those types of groceries that will come, delivery services will come to your neighborhood. Just sit down and just do a lesson, and you'll understand what the red line is all about. So I'm going to stop right here because I know I can get caught up, but it's all about the people. And just know when you hear certain things or see certain things, Ms. Arnold's not ready. She's ready. It's all about the deal, and I'm not for sale. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson hasn't spoken yet, so we'll let Mr. Wilson speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. May I address Councilman Griggs?
Please.
I just had a quick question. What was your reason for eliminating option two?
I support option one more.
That's it? Okay. All right. Can I have Ms. Davis? Thank you. You stated that an individual, Councilman Kleiman stated that there's a chart that designates how much an area can receive up to 110% for that area. And are there any rent control laws in Texas?
No.
Okay. So at any point in time, a owner may increase the rent beyond that particular amount?
As long as the tenant is in a lease, they cannot increase it during the lease period. But when the lease period is over with, they're already in the lease, they can increase it.
They can increase it. So that really doesn't help us what we're trying to do. Doesn't create any more opportunities for voucher users. So that's the difficulty in what we're fighting. And I've said this before, when we talk about affordable housing, we talk about the options, and this is not unique to Dallas, because show me anywhere in Texas where we don't have this problem. And we talked about it being in urban areas. It's also in small towns. I grew up in small town Texas, where that you're either designated or segregated an area by some physical barrier, a highway, a railroad, or a creek or something, mm-hmm. that's separated. This is something that Austin has been fighting for years, and even with their policies and rules, and I think it goes back to the 80s, when HUD was really active in trying to do the very same thing we're trying to do now, and you compare that map then and you compare it now, it's virtually the same. This is not an easy solution, not a overnight process, and I'm just curious to see or to hear. The reason I ask why did we select that one is what's the alternative? What solutions do we have beyond this? Because really when you look at the way that housing has always been built, there's always been a lower income area and a higher income area. And I know that we're trying to get to a component to where that we have more mixed income housing. I think that's the answer in terms of regulating how we do mixed income housing. You look at what's done in Chicago, where we have multifamily or single-family dwellings in brownstones. You have a $300,000 townhome next to a $100,000 brownstone, and no one knows the difference unless you just come out and just tell them how much you're paying. It makes it really difficult to try to go into an area that's already established by market basis to try to control that because, believe it or not, if you're renting out that property, all you're doing is looking at the data, and you're just looking for the next number to raise it to. So you're really chasing it. This is complex, and it is real. So the voucher system, there's a lag time in terms of payment for that owner?
if the program works as designed, there should not be a long lag time, because initially when a client goes in and they're certified as being eligible and they fill out all of the paperwork and the inspection is done on the apartment, once all of that is done, there should not be a lag unless there is, you know, a problem. If the unit is not maintained properly and the tenant makes a complaint or an inspection is done and the property owner does not make the repairs, there could be a delay for that reason. But otherwise, they should be receiving the rent payments within a reasonable amount of time.
Okay, but reasonable amount of time. What is that typical reasonable amount of time? If there's no problems, good place, inspection?
I would say in most cases, we don't hear very many complaints about delays in payments unless there is a problem with the unit. So I think they, for the most part, are receiving their money just like they would on a regular basis at a certain time of the month, every month.
Okay, so again, it goes back to our the need for more affordable housing and building of more affordable housing or multifamily units. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. Mr. Kingston, second row.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Just a couple of cleanup issues. I think I would like to, and I think we will be, in housing or maybe in economic development, talking about an incentive program going forward. But this is step one. We got to see how this works. If it works without an incentive, then we shouldn't spend the money. If it doesn't work, then we can always follow up with that. But this is absolutely step one. I just wanted to say that I really wish that Mr. Griggs would roll his sleeves up and we would stop spending so much time in the housing committee watching daytime TV and eating bonbons. I think it's incredible how little work we've done. Quite amazing. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I got in just before the mayor got back, so I got to call you Madam Mayor. You know, I think in all this discussion, there's some basic facts. You know, and one of them is you can go to 110% above market rate, and that the tables are updated every March. So this isn't a situation, a federal government issue where, oh, heavens forbid, they think it updated 7 years from now, and they completely miss the marketplace. Now, where an owner of a building, if he's in Uptown, might be affected is if his rents are going up so exponentially and he's turning over his stock, well, he may lose the opportunity cost of renting out a couple of units in a 200-unit complex for a few months. But if his rents are going up that much in demand, it's not like people are moving out. There's a reason that rents go up, because there's demand for the units. So anything to say that people are going to be disproportionately affected and they're going to go out of business is either A, disingenuous, two, ill-informed, but at the best, it's a fallacious argument. The other thing is, this is the fact. You know, the fact is, this takes away the excuse for you to deny somebody based on their source of income. You know, if somebody has a voucher that will pay, Mr. Wilson asked it himself, they pay on time. I know a lot of people, I have tenants, they don't pay me on time. My wife hates me because I don't get rent on time, but they don't pay on time. Government does. So this just takes away the capacity for somebody to have an excuse to say, yeah, I don't want to rent to people like you. So that's what this is. So I would just encourage us to stand for the right things. If it goes to a state level and we get our head thumped for it, fine. At least we stood for something. But we are not going to make people go out of business because the tables get set every March. And anything to say it is just plain wrong. So thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I know a lot's been said about, you know, past fair housing laws, and I've read my history books, and I was in favor of the 68 fair housing law, the 78 fair housing law, all of the above. This is not, folks, about skin color. You know, this is about really socioeconomic status is really what it's about. All kinds of people on the Section 8 program, don't buy into this that it's just about skin color. It's not. It's just not. All kinds of people. I've leased to black, white, brown, male, female, young and old, Asian, all kinds of people on this program. So they're out there. Well over 30,000 units are controlled in one way or another by Housing Authority, either with vouchers or public assistance or housing projects or so forth. So a lot of that type of thing is available. We even have other units that are not subsidized. They're just simply low-cost units. So I wanted to be on record about that. And I wanted to underscore again, the U.S. Congress, regardless of party affiliation, in both Democratic and Republican administrations have maintained that Housing Choice Voucher Program, Section 8 participation, should be voluntary. Again, voluntary, not mandatory. And as I want to quote this, as a former head of one of the Texas' largest housing authorities recently pointed out, the current housing voucher system has a number of impediments that create a barrier for widespread acceptance by the apartment industry, including unreliable payment schedules, delays that impact the economics of the property, and difficulty and delays in the eviction process. It causes trouble. So voting in favor of this item really, in essence, creates rent controls. Let's go through this slowly. If you raise the rent, let's say this is an owner, he wants to raise the rent, he's got to execute a new owner-driven lease, he's got to execute a new HUD or DHA lease, and then to get the higher rental increases, and if the voucher doesn't support that, then you're relegated to accepting the current rent and not changing anything, and basically artificially low, or and then the owner-investor becomes non-compliant with the new ordinance or policy. So again, you either accept the lower rate, or you're not compliant because you say, well, I can't accept the lower rate because I can't pay my bills with this lower interest. Now, why would that happen? Okay, let's say you've got a five-year deal. I'm just going to grab a Bank of America. You've got a five-year mortgage with Bank of America. All of a sudden, 5 years goes by, they raise the interest rate on you. So now you've got a larger mortgage payment. You've got now higher taxes because the city of Dallas, you know, decided they would raise based on what the values of the properties were. Your insurance rates, they go up because there's more claims, there's more loss in the insurance industry for all kinds of reasons. So now your operating costs are going higher. Let's say you were getting $825 a month, but now your operating costs have exceeded that $825 a month. Now you've got negative cash flow. I'm in the business again. Your net operating income goes down. You have a responsibility to pay. So, again, you've got basically a loaded gun to your head. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. I have heard a number of people around this horseshoe say that we should look for some kind of alternative program, and I did propose that to the Housing Committee, an attainable housing certificate program that I think would be worth looking into further. And be happy to discuss that with anybody. But nevertheless, I did want to ask a few questions about the number of vouchers that are being unused. Can somebody help me with that? There's been this claim that there are all these vouchers out there that are unused because there's not units available. And maybe we can start with approximately how many just total units are there in the city of Dallas.
Right. One of the briefings that we sent you last Friday had that listing by council district. Roughly of housing choice vouchers, we're looking at 17,000 to 18,000 vouchers across the entire city okay. being used. There are, as folks move away or as vouchers are unused, those folks, the number right now has been floated at about 1,100 vouchers where a person has been issued a voucher but can't find a unit.
Okay. And about how many just total units in the city just for families are there? If you just take single family and multifamily and all that.
Right. I think the number that you guys were looking at is roughly in the 200,000
right.
number
right. okay.
for apartment
so
units.
So a little bit shy of 10% are available for this type of
Actually, you'll be also looking at vacancy rates at this time. So vacancy rates are very low, probably running about 3%.
So I've heard a lot of that argument, yet I go to the Dallas Housing Authority website, and they're showing 758 units currently available to use housing vouchers in. So I kind of have a disconnect between people saying there aren't units available, but DHA itself has 758 units available. So where, can you help me reconcile that disconnect?
Sure. DHA also owns their own housing, so there's public housing. But if folks want a choice of where else to live, then they typically are issued vouchers.
Yeah, and these aren't just DHA. These aren't just DHA properties. These are DHA rentals and all other rentals that accept have affordable housing. So I do find the struggle for more affordable housing. I understand why that's important, but when we have almost 10% of our entire housing stock eligible already, just by virtue of the fact that we know, you know, 17,000 out of 200,000 units, plus I see, 750 places available where people can use a voucher. You know, I'm concerned that we would, create, policy that's, I don't want to say a policy that's chasing a problem, but because I do know affordability is an issue in this city. But let the facts speak for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Glazen, third round.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Is one of the reasons that those units are unoccupied the fact that these are in the most disenfranchised areas in the city with the worst schools, with the worst access to health care, and the worst access to jobs?
I think that's probably a reasonable assumption. I haven't looked at that list, so I can't with certainty say that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to very quickly say that one of the issues about this is this will not increase more affordable housing. It won't. There's only a fixed amount of units. The only thing this does is it makes these folks have a reasonable shot to get housing as opposed to having a built-in excuse to turn them down. So it's still first come, first serve, but at least they can't be denied based on the fact that their source of income is a voucher. So I will be supportive still. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Well, I hope if our federal partners are listening, they hear that we are very serious about this issue. A lot of passion, a lot of discussion. We spent a good much of last week, I think, talking about the housing policy, and we are planning to get that housing policy done and make sure that we are in compliance with all the requests that they asked. One of the requests they asked is for us to take this issue up, and so I appreciate, Mr. Griggs, your leadership on this and everybody's discussion and debate on it. Affordable housing is critical in this city, making sure that we continue to grow for everybody, is extremely important if we're going to be a world-class city, as Ms. Young talked about. I find myself in a place where I agree with everybody in this because I think everybody's right. The question is, how do you move forward? And I think that you've got one issue that says, as Ms. Young said again, if you see a good fight, jump in. And I always say, if you see a good fight, go win it. And I like to win fights. And so I'm trying to think about doing that. And the second side is making sure that we are honest and doing everything we can for those that are being discriminated against. Because make no doubt about it, they're being discriminated against. And it frustrates me to no end when discrimination takes place because of whether it's a color of the skin or more or because they're homeless or because of some other issue. And that's not acceptable, and we've got to deal with it. The problem is it's going to come off, as Ms. Gates said, that if we pass this, everybody's going to get it. And it's just not true. It is just wrong. Now, if we pass it, we get in a fight. And I'm not afraid of a good fight. And I let the judges make their decisions. I have no problem, as you know, taking on things. I like to make sure I win fights. And I've gotten very clear coaching that there is like about a minuscule chance of winning this. Okay, so we're just doing it for the sake of saying we're doing it. I don't like that, those odds. Now, Mr. Wilson raised, I kind of like option two, because this was legal. This was a way that we could make headway on this. Some of you may not like that, too, because we're getting into the housing product again. But I think it's a great way to approach this. But that's not the motion on the floor. So I hate to be leading our taxpayers down a rosy path that is going to fall off a cliff. And so I'm going to have a tough time supporting this, and we'll sure. Ms. Elazio, you had a question?
Yes, sir. I wanted to extend that, but I wasn't sure where you were going. I was waiting to finish because I think that
I'm just going to go voting.
The conversation was about the number two says that we're prohibited by law, and I think that that's important, as everybody was talking about the legalities. And if that's the case, Mr. Mayor, I make that motion for number two. Substitute motion. Excuse me.
Hold on. All right. Do we have a second? Is that deleterious, Mr. Castro? Remember the interview? You said you'd make these rulings real quick. Okay, great. All right. Great. That's what. So we will vote on the first motion. Record vote, Mr. Kingston.
Please cast your vote. All have voted on the motion. Voting in favor, Council Members Medrano, Arnold, Clayton, Kingston, Griggs, and Young. Voting against, Council Members McGue, Thomas, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Wilson, Council Members Gates, Kleinman, Mayor Rawlings, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem, Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo, Council Members Callahan and Grayson. The motion fails, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Now we'll take up the motion for...
I move to approve Ordinance 2.
No, Ms. Alonzo already did.
No, it was out of order because it's deleterious.
Oh, okay. Excuse me. Everybody, hold on. Mr. Griggs has the courage to make motion number two, okay? And Mr. Kingston says two. All right, I'll vote.
I have the courage to vote on number one.
I'll vote on it.
Sorry, one moment.
Point of order. May we not discuss item two? I don't think we really.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't think we really even have had an opportunity to weigh in on this.
Mr. Callahan, thank you. You're right. Please weigh in, Mr. Callahan, before we vote.
Yeah, I just think this is just as laden. You know, again, nobody else is doing number two either. Granted, we need to find a way to get to a solution there. I agree with that totally. But I think we ought to work with the housing community, the home builders and so forth, to be able to try to get there with the apartment groups, et cetera. I don't know if people have ever stopped to see what happened in some of the large cities like Detroit. My dad lived in Detroit in the late 40s. There was 2 million people in that town. There's 700,000 people in that town now. They've knocked down all kinds of houses because they had forced rent controls. They had all kind of challenges with that. Mayor, you want to grow the disposable income in the city. That doesn't mean we're trying to exit or out-migrate people that don't have a lot of income, but you can't pay the bills if everybody is on a housing voucher or people don't have any money. So you're going to open the door for other housing authorities external to Dallas, Texas. They're going to come back to Dallas because guess what? This is a mandatory program. Let's not make this mandatory, people. Let's make it voluntary. Let's strengthen it. Let's take out some of the bureaucratic nature of the Section 8 program so it works for people. But again, I told you before in my illustration, you can't pay your bills when you're stuck at a certain rate. If your expenses are $1,000 and you're getting $825 because the city of Dallas says you've got to, guess what you got? -$175 a month cash flow. Then you got 10, 20, 30, 50, or 100 of these houses or several hundred apartments. You can't pay your bills. You're going to see foreclosures. You're going to see boards go up on the bill. I'm old enough to remember all this stuff. I know what it was like in the early 80s. I know what it was like just a few years ago. It was terrible in Pleasant Grove. That's what really happened to Pleasant Grove. Late 80s, everything went to the RTC, Southwest Plan, stuff sold 10 cents on the dollar, boards everywhere, drug enforcement agencies showed up in the town because it was just a total mess. You know, the murder rate was horrible, terrible. because the only way you could get rid of these things, if someone had a pulse, a heartbeat, a job, you know, move in special, let's get some bodies, that was quote unquote, let's get some bodies in these units so we can pay our bills. And as soon as they got bodies in, they turned and flipped them off to somebody else. So this has led to a reign of terror. We now have not a middle-income community. We have now a lower socioeconomic income there. We've got bad actors, bad people living in these houses and apartments. They're not law-abiding in many cases. And this is where the challenge goes. So we've got to do a better, balanced job. I hate to be the purveyor of truth, but you've got to lay it out the way things really are. And I've seen it. I've been there in that market for 37 years. And I want to grow this area. I want to give economic choice, economic opportunity. Everyone's always saying, we need some economic development over here. Well, you're not ever going to get economic development if everyone's making $15,000, $20,000 a year. God bless them. I know everybody can't be wealthy. And I'm not even talking about wealthy people. I'm just talking about working people making $30,000, $40,000 a year live in my community. But I want to build my community based on the ability to pay rather than the inability to pay. But making this not volitional, or rather making it mandatory, is certainly not the way to go. So I'm not in favor of either option one or two. I would like to step back, work with all the groups that are responsible, get the Dallas Housing Authority, get the Apartment Association involved, the builders groups involved. Let's craft a policy that makes sense. This does not make sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. I had a question about the portion of this that affects zoning density refrain from discrimination of holders, and also the multifamily projects receiving city subsidies. We came up with 10%. So there, are we mandating that they have to have, if you received a city subsidy, 10% of your units have to be housing vouchers? Is that what we're saying with this?
Yes. Hi, Robin Bentley, City
Thank
Attorney's
you,
Office. The committee made two recommendations. One was that recipients of funding from the city and recipients of zoning density bonuses, which is not a concept that currently exists in our code, it would be a future conversation, would have to accept, could not discriminate against federal housing vouchers. Same argument as ordinance number one. They also recommended that folks accepting funds from the city would set aside 10% of their units for voucher holders. Two separate concepts.
Okay, so what if they couldn't fill 10% with voucher holders? Would those just remain empty units? I mean, what if they are, you know, I thought we were trying to look for affordable housing. What if they had, you know, other recipients that didn't have voucher holder but qualified as affordable? So would it be affordable plus the 10%, which would be voucher holders?
And they would likely overlay affordable units would be filled by voucher holders.
Likely, but we don't know.
They wouldn't have to, but
so if they didn't have come forward, you didn't have people with vouchers come forward for their units, they would just have to hold them empty? Or how do you see that occurring?
That's a very good question. I guess that would be an enforcement question of would it be a discrimination claim or a violation of 20A if there were no available voucher holders?
So could we have an explanation or not? So I just, that part, I don't, this part that starts to talk about the city subsidies and the zoning is kind of territory that we are talking about including in our housing policy, but we don't, which we haven't passed yet. And like you said, it's further conversation. So it's like we're passing law that we don't even know what that law looks like because we haven't passed that law. We don't know what that zoning density looks like. Is that, would you say that's fair?
It's a fair point. The committee made these recommendations last January. So this is moving a little quicker than the other.
So it's mentioning things in this policy that we're adopting, but that reference a policy that's not adopted at this time.
The density bonus concept has not passed yet, correct?
So I can't support adopting of this when I don't even know what that density bonus is going to look like. I mean, it's kind of like what we heard about affordable care. Let's pass the act before we know how it's what's in the act. And now we've seen, you know, nationally where that's gotten us. And so we're doing the same here at the city. We're saying, let's pass this and let's include something related to zoning density. And then, but we don't even know what that definition is going to be. I mean, I'm sorry, but I just can't. I know where the intention is, but we've got to have this policy in place before we can pass these mandates. And I, you know, you can phrase it, you can make us look like we're big, bad, and ugly, but we're not. We're trying to do sensible things. And you know what? The government needs to be sensible and reasonable. And this is not being sensible or reasonable when you're asking me to pass something that you don't even know what it looks like. So I'm sorry, Mayor, but that's, you know, until we have that policy in place, I don't think we should be mandating what property owners need to be doing. So, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question with regarding to these two components that would be requiring 10% public subsidy or zoning. Do we currently have a public subsidy affordable housing policy? Does someone from economic development want to answer that, or?
Yes, Mr. Kleinman, but only for tax increment financing districts.
So we do have a policy in the city of Dallas that if you get public subsidy, that you're required to give affordable housing. Then do we have a policy currently that says if you get entitlements or zoning things that you are requirement for affordable housing?
We do not have that right.
So would you say that the basis, that one of the reasons that we do provide zoning entitlements is because of increases in property value that generates more property taxes?
Yes, and the urbanization of our community.
Urbanization of our, okay. So how many, I know the zoning, I mean the housing committee's been working on this very hard. How many affordable units are needed in the city of Dallas?
We don't know yet.
So why are we passing, okay.
We don't know that yet.
If the answer is we don't know, why were we looking at a policy that's required that? How many affordable units, how many voucher affordable units will this policy create in the city of Dallas?
I don't think we know the answer to that question.
Thank you. Okay, so we can't be, we have to be goal-oriented. We have to have something that we're trying to attain, and if it's a number of affordable units in the city, then we need to know how many we need and how many a policy is going to create. And until we have that, I cannot vote in favor of anything that's going to put requirements that we don't even know the outcome of. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clayton.
Bernie, do we have a need for affordable housing in the city?
I can inherently say yes.
Is it more than one?
Yes.
Okay. So we know we have a need for affordable housing. So on this provision, basically, right now if you take tax increment dollars, we say if you're going to do residential, you have to do 20%. This is 10. This is something that we came out of the housing committee and said, listen, let's make a reasonable incentive. You know, heavens forbid the Eagles don't come fly down here so we get to see who's the most patriotic about freedom of choice for developers. But they are asking us for money. When they want an upzone in density or they want a change in density, they're asking us for a favor. We're asking them for a favor back. And our favor back is, hey, listen, please set aside some units that are 110% the area median income, which is market rate, by the way, because Dallas income is lower than the regional average. So, Bernie, that's all I have for you. So I just don't think this is an unfair thing to ask, that if you're going to ask for something that is going to make you more money, pure profit, that you get something, that we get something in return. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Why don't we vote?
Please cast your vote. All have voted. Voting in favor, Council Members Medrano, Arnold, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Wilson, Councilmember Clayton, Mayor Rawlings, Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo, Councilmembers Kingston, Griggs, and Young. Voting against, Councilmembers McGew, Thomas, Gates, Kleinman, Callahan, and Grayson. The motion carries, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas has a vent downstairs I ask everybody to go to. And Mr. Griggs, I think you're up.
Thank you. I think we may have a very special birthday today that I would like to recognize. None other than Mr. Philip Kingston. His birthday's coming up.
And
so
then
he's
Mr.
got a great kick.
And then Mr.
Here.
Medrano.
I'm
sorry, Ms. Young. I got it backwards.
I can send the bill to Mr. Griggs.
I didn't want to steal your thunder. So I was going to. Now I'm going to hand things off to someone with an equally important announcement. And that's Councilmember Tiffany Young.
We also are celebrating the birthday of Councilman Medrano. Am I supposed to sing?
Yes, you're supposed to lead us. Please.
Happy birthday to y'all. Y'all don't know that version? Happy birthday to...
You. Okay. It is 11:48 p.m. We're going to meet go downstairs in the plaza right now, and then lunchroom at 1 o'clock. Lunchroom at 1 o'clock. It is 11:48 p.m. On October 26, 2016, the City Council will now go into closed session at 1 p.m. under the Section 551071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, receive advice from and consult with the city attorney on the following matters. Legal issues related to meet and confer negotiations between city and police and fire associations, David Sewell et al. V. Dallas County Schools, the City of Dallas, and the City of Carrollton. Thank you. It is 2:01 p.m. The council has completed its closed session under Section 551071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and we have returned to open session on October 26. Ms. Rios.
I do want to clarify that on agenda item 38, when the vote was taken, Councilmember Kingston was voting no on adoption. So we proceed now on agenda item number 38. That was the Performing Arts Center for Performing Arts.
Right, he was talking.
And he wanted
talking.
To clarify for the record, Councilmember Kingston.
No, it's fine. He was He was over there. I saw him.
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Medrano would like to be recognized on agenda item number 55.
Mr. Medrano.
Thank you, Mayor. I would like to defer item number 55 to November 9th, 2016.
Need a vote, Mr. Mayor.
What's that?
We need a vote.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were waiting for you. I'm sorry. So you had a second? I didn't hear the second. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Councilmember Young would like to be recognized on agenda item number 57.
Ms. Young.
I move to defer item number 57 to the January 5th, 2017 meeting.
A motion is second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you. We proceed now with your consent zoning agenda. And that consists of agenda items number 49 through 54.
Excuse me, Ms. Arnold, did you want to say something? Okay, go ahead.
Agenda items 49 through 54. Agenda item 54 is pulled for individual consideration by Councilmember Young. Therefore, remaining on your consent zoning docket, our agenda items 49 through 53. Those will be read into the record, after which speakers will be called. Agenda item number 49 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting an amendment to and renewal of specific use permit number 1805 for an open enrollment charter school on property on the southwest corner of Syene Road and Pritchard Lane. Agenda item 50 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting a planned development district for a local utility and single-family uses on property on the east corner of Barnesbridge Road and Ferguson Road. Agenda item 51 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting the creation of a new sub-area to allow an alternative financial establishment use by specific use permit within sub-area 2 within planned development district number 366, and number 2, an ordinance granting a specific use permit for an alternative financial establishment use on the southeast corner of Lake June Road and South Buckner Boulevard. Agenda item 52 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting the renewal of specific use permit number 1912 for a late hours establishment limited to an alcoholic beverage establishment for a bar, lounge, or tavern on property on the west side of Greenville Avenue, south of Sears Street. Agenda item 53 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting the renewal of and an amendment to specific use permit number 1767 for an alcoholic beverage establishment limited to a bar, lounge, or tavern, and the addition of an inside commercial amusement use limited to a live music venue on property north of Commerce Street, east of South Good Latimer Expressway. Are there any individuals that would like to speak in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve the item? Any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. We have a second. A motion is second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor. Who made the motion, please?
Mr. Kingston.
Kingston, thank you. We move now to agenda item number 54, a public hearing and an ordinance granting a specific use permit for local utilities limited to utility services on property on the southwest line of Bank Street, southeast of Herndon Street.
Mr. Mayor, we sent 12 notices to property owners within 200 feet of the area of request. We received no replies in favor and none in opposition.
Are there any speakers that would like to speak in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve? Any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Ms. Young.
I move to approve the zoning change with the revised site plan and landscape plan that was distributed today depicting the new location of a fence.
Thank you. Do we have a second? Thank you. Any discussion?
Yes. So initially, colleagues, this location, it is over near Fair Park. The fencing only covered a piece of the properties, and so the new map, it covers all the parking lot, and it fences in everything.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
We move now to agenda item number 56, a public hearing and an ordinance granting the renewal of specific use permit number 1905 for a late hours establishment limited to a restaurant without drive-in or drive-through use on property on the west line of Greenville Avenue, south of Sears Street.
Mr. Mayor, we sent 20 notices to property owners within 200 feet of the area of request. We received 5 replies in favor and none in opposition.
Are there any speakers in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve? Any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Kingston.
Mr. Mayor, may I ask the applicant a couple questions and then make a motion?
Please.
Do you mind coming down, Mr. Randall?
Sir, if you would please state your name.
My name is Sammy Mandel.
How long is your lease?
I've got another 4 years on it.
Okay. I was going to ask you also, what was the award you guys got recently, or the recognition?
Yeah, we just got recognized as being one of the 100 fastest inner city businesses in the country.
Awesome.
Yeah.
In that case, Mr. Mayor, my motion is going to be to adopt the staff recommendation for a 4-year period. Greenville Avenue Pizza Company is really one of the stalwarts on Greenville, and Sammy and his wife started this business really in the midst of the recession, and were able to grow this, and while the street was torn up, and they were able to grow this business really regardless of everything that we've thrown at them.
Second. No motion, second. Any discussion?
The only negative about them is that they live in District 9. Everything else about them is pretty much perfect. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor. I didn't hear who made the second.
Ms. Grayson.
Thank you very much. Agenda item number 58 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting the renewal of specific use permit number 1954 for a commercial amusement inside limited to a Class A dance hall on property on the northwest corner of Singleton Boulevard and Peoria Avenue.
Mr. Mayor, we sent 26 notices to property owners within 300 feet of the area of request. We received 4 replies in favor and none in opposition.
Are there any speakers in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve? Any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Ms. Alonzo.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I make a motion to close the public hearing and approve this item as recommended by the staff with the following change. No parking, loading, and unloading, only signs must be installed and maintained in front of the facade facing Singleton Boulevard.
The motion is second. No discussion. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 59 is a public hearing and an ordinance granting a CR Community Retail District on property on the southeast corner of West Keast Boulevard and South Polk Street.
Mr. Mayor, we sent 33 notices to property owners within 300 feet of the area of request. We received 3 replies in favor and 6 in opposition.
Are there any speakers in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve? Sir, if you'll please come forward. Please state your name and address for the record. Address your comments to Mayor Rawlings and stay to the topic, please. 3 minutes.
My name is Akbar Alana. Address is 2475 South Walker Hill, Dallas, Texas. I actually conducted a neighborhood meeting for this to get their opinion on this. And also I visited the neighbors and visited the surrounding and got the petition signed. And I would like to submit this sign-in sheet and petition for your record.
Thank you, sir. If you'll go ahead and pass it over. Thank you.
That's all I have. If you have any questions.
Thank you.
All right, sir.
Thank you. Are there any other speakers in opposition to the CPC recommendation to approve? Any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Yes, Mayor and Council, I move to approve the zoning changes recommended by the City Plan Commission.
Second.
And a motion and a second. Discussion?
Yes. Well, really, I want to thank him for continuing to work with the community, and we've deferred this particular agenda item. So I made a request that he go back and reach out to the community and get the documentation that we would need. He is in an area that is of concern because we're looking for growth there, and we've shared that with him. And we've got to, and I'm committed to doing my part, and the city encouraging that we work to get some of those. I know we have a slumlord in that area, but on the corner, the zone where you are, I think we have a chance to start some things that's new. So I do want to thank you very much publicly for your efforts to cooperate. Thank you.
Thank you. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item number 60 is a public hearing regarding amendments to Chapter 51 and Chapter 51A of the Dallas Development Code, Section 51-4.217 and Section 51A-4.217, accessory uses, providing regulations for book exchange structures as accessory outside storage, and an ordinance granting the amendments. We do have one individual registered on this item, Amruta Sakalker. Ms. Sakalker, if you'll please come forward. State your name and address for the record. Address your comments to Mayor Rawlings and stay to the topic. If you would please state whether you're in favor or in opposition as well. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Councilmember Tiffany Yang, Councilmember Michael, and everyone present here. Thank you for listening to me. I'm against this particular proposal. First of all, I would like to thank the city staff for their efforts on the proposal. At the same time, I stand in front of you to express my disappointment towards the extreme prescriptive nature of the regulations that are currently being proposed As a designer by profession, when I first drove down Dallas, I was impressed by the creativity expressed by the skyline of the city. I was excited that I would be working in a city that lives and respects creativity. But the way the city is handling the little free libraries, I'm a little dispirited. Recently, the city staff added research regarding already existing little free libraries in the Dallas, in this proposal. This was added after the quality of life meeting. I again thank the staff for doing this research because it has been very helpful. It also clearly states that the current proposal is much more restrictive and makes it impractical and not supportive of the program. If the city is hoping to set a positive example to support the literacy program, to support literacy programs like Little Free Library, the current proposal is definitely not doing that. If the ordinance is passed and if the ordinance is passed as is, Dallas will not be celebrated as the first few cities to legalize Little Free Libraries. It, on the contrary, it will be the first city in the country to make regulations that will bring down at least 20 of these existing Little Free Libraries, which as per my understanding is 50% of what are currently in the city. Do we really think that that is supportive of the program? As a former designer with Building Community Workshop, I've been going to different parts of the city to find neighborhoods that can benefit from this program. Neighborhoods like Redbird are book deserts. Sustainable literary material is almost impossible to find. That is why Little Free Libraries program helps to alleviate that. And when the neighborhood works together and designs something, it makes the program much more sustainable and people support it better. The size limitation actually doesn't allow for design to be easily be a guiding factor. Lastly, I wish to ask, why are we regulating the size of Little Free Libraries when we are making these regulations? If you see the existing regulations, landscaping elements, lawn furniture, ornament structures don't have any size limitations. So you can go as large as you want. So why Little Free Libraries? Why are we restricting those sizes so much? I'm sure if the city wants to support these programs, we need to make sure that it is not made impractical and we are celebrating people's creativity than stifling it and making it impossible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other speakers that would like to speak on the item, either in opposition to the CPC recommendation? Sir, you may please come forward. Are you speaking in opposition? Thank you. Please state your name and address for the record. You do have 3 minutes.
My name is Seth Hewlett. I'll be speaking later. But on this topic, I'm against the regulations. I haven't been able to go far in depth with it. But if our current regulations allow the free libraries to exist, then we should encourage the free libraries as much as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other speakers in opposition? We do have an individual coming forward. We will be calling speakers in favor shortly. Please stay to the topic, sir, and address your comments to Mayor Rawlings.
Thank you, Mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem, members of council. My name is Patrick Blaze. I am an associate at Building Community Workshop here in Dallas at 416 South Irving Street. We have helped facilitate the design of 19 of these different Little Free Libraries in asset-poor communities here in our city. We believe they're a great tool that helps empower communities, build neighborhoods, promote literacy, that foster creativity and create a unique sense of community here in our city. Based upon our experience with these libraries, city staff did approach us and solicit our opinion about how to create regulations for these libraries. We reached out to major cities across America, across Texas, to survey them to understand how they regulate these libraries. Essentially, they said, we figure out a way to make these legal. These are great and wonderful things. Our city staff just understand, make them work within the current parameters of our regulations. As one city attorney told me, a good attorney doesn't tell you what you can and can't do, but a city attorney tells you, or you tell the attorney what you want to do, and then he helps you accomplish that. With that understanding, our recommendation to city staff was to allowed these as ornamental structures, as a bird bath, as a birdhouse, as a arbor, as a statue. These are already allowed in front yards. If we just allowed these little free libraries under that particular definition, we could move on to bigger and better issues that our city can tackle. Obviously, staff has decided to move in a different direction, but they've been very good and very wonderful about working with us to understand the implications of those regulations. Chief among the issues that we brought up is because of the way that the ordinance is written, all little free libraries today would become illegal, and it's a very difficult thing to tell little Johnny and little Susie that the thing they worked so hard on, they built it legally, and now they have to tear it down. Furthermore, the way the ordinance is currently written, it puts a very large burden upon city staff to interpret that ordinance. When you go out there and you look at little free libraries, some of these little free libraries are attached to birdhouses, some are attached to park benches, some are attached to fence posts. And so where do you make the difference between saying that this is a book exchange structure and this is an ornamental structure, and where is the code compliance officer measuring this from, and you know, trying to figure out and work through the ordinance. We believe that it ends up putting a large burden upon the city where you can easily call these a ornamental structure and move forward with it. Lastly, I encourage council to really put some thought into the stories that are going to be written tomorrow about what Dallas is doing with Little Free Libraries. Not necessarily what staff or council's intent are, but what the results and the implications of the ordinance that you're passing. Is the article on BuzzFeed or the viral post on Facebook going to come out saying that Dallas is the first city to allow these? Or is it going to be the article that comes out that says that Dallas has created undue burden and regulations to specifically remove certain little free libraries? And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Are there any other speakers in opposition? Are there any speakers in favor? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. I'll entertain a motion.
I think it's quality of life.
Okay. Please, Ms. Grayson, I'm sorry.
I'm going to make this motion in full anticipation that it's going to change after we've had some discussion on this. I see the screen is lit up. And then I'd like to make some comments after I make the motion. I move to approve the code amendment as recommended by the City Plan Commission with the following change. The allowed dimensions are increased to 6 feet by 2 feet by 21 inches.
Do we have a second? Okay, we have a motion and a second.
Just,
well, Ms. Grayson.
Just for purposes of discussion, thank you, Ms. Alonzo. One of the things that was accomplished by this change in size is to make a whole lot more of these legal instead of illegal. One of the gentlemen who came up to speak said, you know, if they're allowed, just let them be. The trouble is our development code as currently written doesn't allow them. So we're trying to find a way to allow them with a minimal amount of regulation. I mean, this is a little free library. I think we all think it's a great idea. It's just that how do you allow them? So we have size considerations, we have adjacency considerations, and we have waiver considerations. So you can say, as we discuss this, we don't want any size restrictions. Let them be as big as people want them to be. Is that what we want to do? We could say we don't want any adjacency restrictions. It can be right next to your neighbor's property line, and it could look like it's more by their house than it is your house, and some neighbors don't want that. So should we not have any adjacency considerations? If we do put in some rules and regs related to size, and we try and make it a size that would make most of the existing ones legal and conforming, then what happens with the ones that remain that still are not meeting those size and adjacency restrictions? Do we create some sort of waiver policy? And how would we create that? Is it the director of planning that gets to grant a waiver? Is it on residential property, non-residential property? You know, this seems so easy, and in the end, you all may decide it's easy and find a way to make it easy. But we have found in quality of life as we've struggled with this, it's not as easy as it looks. And so, you know, I think the idea, and I think maybe what this council wants is we want these. These are great in the neighborhoods, but do you have some minimal regulation? And if you do, which regulations? And do you create a waiver? And so I'm going to be very interested in hearing this discussion. And as I said, with the full anticipation that my motion may be considerably changed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Medrano.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. I was just wondering, do we know how many of these libraries we have in the city?
Do we have an absolute number that I can attest to? No. But I can say is that the ones that appear on the websites, the Los Libres and the Little Free Library site, they show 48. Now, we know not all of those are there, but we suspect some others probably are there.
Okay. Because, yeah, definitely this is an issue for me because I have several. If we pass this today, they would have to be knocked down. And I know that some of the kids and their parents in several of my neighborhoods took time to build these. And some of them have to do with the distance. They're not as far or away that they're supposed to be, so something as simple as that. I'm definitely not going to support this today. We're here, and I was on the school board, and we promoted literacy, and I think this is a great way to also meet neighbors and build a community, so I'm definitely not going to be supporting this today. Maybe we can take it back to quality of life and look at it. I know you said you looked at it, but maybe we can really all put our heads together and try to figure this out. So thank you.
Could I comment on that?
Yes.
Mr. Medrano, can you hear me?
It's going to be hard. Everybody's going to have to get off. Mr. Griggs, if you can get off.
Can we do it?
There we go. You're up.
Thank you, Mayor. I just, in response to what Mr. Medrano said about taking it.
No, I'll just talk to him.
Okay. In response to what Mr. Medrano was saying, one of our options is that we can take no action on this today and take it back to either quality of life or the full council, because now we're discussing it at full council. So I just wanted you all to be aware that we have that option. If we can't come to an agreement or there's too many, you know, ideas on this, we can always defer it today, and you let us know whether you want it to go back to quality of life or full council. Thank you.
Okay. No. I would like that, because I didn't know about it until I got some calls from some of my constituents that there was an issue. So if we can do that, I really would appreciate it. Thank you.
Ms. Young.
Yes, thank you. I'm reading the record here, and although the Quality of Life Committee sent it forward, I think I was the lone vote against it, primarily for the same reason that Councilman Medrano has raised, that a few libraries in District 7 would be affected. And I continue to receive emails from those in the district that are concerned about the issue. And one of the issues that I raised during that discussion is what would be the time limit that someone would have to come into compliance. What is the time limit?
Sure. I think in any instance, A, we largely would respond to complaints about structures. I think any things that meet the setbacks, is it not convenient? But I would imagine they could be relocated to conform with those setbacks. So at council's discretion, I mean, typically we would give folks, you know, I don't know that there's any hard and set rule, but certainly, again, we'd largely respond on any complaints received, and those that didn't receive complaints could move them accordingly. But certainly a minimum of 2 months to, and it's likely, again, going to be complaint-based.
And let's go back there. How many complaints have we received currently?
I believe, and I'll let Code
correct me. I did a little bit of research after the Quality of Life Committee meeting and found something different than what was said.
Councilwoman, it's not possible for me to give you an exact count because we don't have a service request type today related to Little Free Libraries, so they can show up as a new building permit, an illegal structure,
so it's not located in the narrative? When someone calls 311, you mean to tell me we're not able to look at a narrative and see that they were calling to complain about a Little Free Library or a structure in a house next door to them or across the street from them? There's no way to...
A structure we do. So an illegal structure we do. But what I'm saying is there's nothing specific to a Little Free Library. So we have not gone through the exhaustive list of all of the illegal structure, for example, service requests to see which ones are Little Free Libraries. What we have done is looked up all the locations where we know there is a Little Free Library located based on the same websites that Mr. Cossin referred to,
from those, there's only been one site that has received complaints. It has
Correct.
Received a total of 11 service requests on that location.
And because of that one site, we're now looking at all of these, all 48 or 49 in the city. And how many complaints came from that one site?
We have a total of 11 service requests.
And what is that site?
It's at 9210 Lynbrook.
9210 Lynbrook?
Yes,
what
ma'am.
District is that?
That is in Mr. McGee's district.
Got it. So, District 10. They don't like the little free libraries out there. Okay. The other question is, when you look at the national website, I mean, we need libraries in District 7, and I did have someone call us saying, well, you know, don't you have mobile? Don't you have services that deliver books to kids' houses? We wish we had that, but we don't. And so this is all some kiddos have in terms of resources, even at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library, where we continue to have a depleted children's section in the library. And so we certainly have some disparity issues across the city, I guess. But when you look at the national website, and I guess you all took a look at that, and there are several different sizes of little free libraries on the national website, how many of those would be in compliance if we were to implement these particular requirements?
As with the motion made by Ms. Grayson, which differed from the recommendation of the City Plan Commission and what came out of Quality of Life, she modified that somewhat. So based on those modifications, we know that 7 likely would not be in compliance, and there may be additional ones because we didn't actually measure very specifically the setback issue. But we know a minimum of 7 of those would not be in compliance with the overall dimensional requirement.
And they would not be in compliance because of the setback or because of the size of
because
the structure?
Because of the size on those. And there may be additional based on setback. We just didn't have the ability to identify the property lines.
And then with the the way that it was that it came forward at Quality of Life Committee, how many would not be in compliance?
Probably about half, about 22 of those.
Okay. And so I would like to make a motion to refer this back to the full council to discuss.
You have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I missed the part at Quality of Life where we knew of little free libraries that were going to be made illegal by these regulations.
Well, today, none of them are legal. In other words, we don't have an ordinance that specifically allows them. So if there is structure in the front yard, technically they would not be legal structures. Now, when we went to Quality of Life the first time, I think we talked about some options
like
to seek direction.
Bird
where
bath
do you want us to
and
go.
Lawn furniture.
Yes, but that was not our direction. So.
Oh. Maybe I wasn't clear. I wanted to treat them like bird baths and lawn furniture. Well, for all you kids listening at home, if anyone ever tells you that one person can't make a difference, just remember that one jerk using 311 in District 10 caused us all to waste our time here today and has caused the loss of hundreds of staff hours. I apologize to you, Mr. Cossum. I did not pay close enough attention to the details of this ordinance. My understanding was that because we don't have anything in the code that specifically allows Mr. Sweckard's code officers to tell somebody stop being a jerk, we needed some rules so that they could say this is permitted, this is not permitted. The whole, Mr. Sweckard, does it suffice if this council simply tells you to ignore little free library calls? Can you do that?
There is nothing in the code as currently written that makes this an allowable structure. So even though you tell us to ignore it, I mean, we've
honestly, we've ignored it up to this point. The first complaint we received was in February 2015. Since we are working on it, we've ignored it, but we can't ignore it forever. It's not legal the way it's written today.
What's the, between the two of you, what's the lightest thing we could do?
I think just to incorporate the mayor as part of a definition of, and it's in an odd place to begin with, but it's under outside storage of what you can have in your front yard. And if that type of structure was specifically stated to be allowed in the front yard, I think that would resolve the issue if you chose not to have any dimensional setback standards.
Mr. Mayor, if I say so moved, do you understand what he's proposing?
I don't understand this whole thing. Okay.
In that case, Mr. Mayor, I won't do that. I'll be supporting Ms. Young's motion, and once we come back to council, that'll be my position. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Griggs.
I would rather just deal with this today. The amount of time that's been spent on this is a huge amount of time, and now we're going to get a full council briefing. We've got so much going on today. So I know it's the motion would be out of order, but I would move just to treat these as a structure that's allowed by right in someone's front yard and be with it today. But I know we've got to dispose of the motion that refers it to a committee of the whole first.
No, you have one more substitute motion.
But then there's precedence, right? City Council rules of procedure, precedence of motions. You guys comment?
Yes, you can make. There's a motion on the floor to defer to full council, and so that.
Defer to committee.
No, as full council. That'll be you included. We want you to enjoy the pain too.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to withdraw. I'm going to withdraw my motion.
All right.
Yay!
All right. We move. Move to just treat these as structures that can be in someone's front yard by right.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Ms. Gates wants to talk about this,
thank
too.
You.
Yeah, if that motion ends all discussions of Little Free Libraries or banning or regulating or getting rid of, that I'm fully supportive of it. We've spent way too much staff time. We've spent too much council time at this point. I don't think there's anybody on this council that opposes Little Free Libraries. They're a wonderful asset. Maybe somebody builds one that's too big. I mean, and I don't, you know, but we've got a big problem in Dallas, and it's not Little Free Libraries. It's just not. And we've got to move on. They should be allowed by right. I don't care if they're this big or that big. I mean, this is one complaint in one area. I mean, we just cannot be known for the city that regulates Little Free Libraries. I mean, what's next? Tree houses and, you know, somebody's...
Careful.
I mean, we're going to go after... we're going to make it not fun for a kid to live in Dallas. And we've got real problems. So let's move on. If you think... If we just ignore this altogether and we don't even take up Mr. Griggs's and we just say no to everything, what's going to happen? What's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to take a library down is what you're going to tell me, Mr. Costa.
Again, I think we're putting code in an extremely unfortunate position. I think we need to have a regulation to either recognize them as a structure permitted in the front yard or establish some type of reasonable standard.
Okay, so that's what Mr. Griggs' motion does. It recognizes them as a structure just like a bird bath or a piece of furniture or a swing set or a tire. I mean, we're going to take tire swings down from yards. I mean, what's next? So I think we just recognize them. That's the simplest thing we can do to make them legal and move on. Is that what you're telling me? Okay, thank you. I'll be supportive of that.
Thank you. I like this. This is one of those discussions where you say you with your wife, we're going to stop arguing, and then it's like, well, let's argue some more. Mr. McGew, you're up next.
Well, I just want to speak on behalf of District 10 and say that we love Little Free Libraries, and that's where this came from, is that the question was, how do we make sure Little Free Libraries are legal and allowed to exist in a way that doesn't negatively impact the community, but the way was, how do we make this legal? And so, I mean, I've said this every time it came up at Quality of Life. I think the best option is what we're talking about here, making it legal, allowing Little Free Libraries by right. The one caveat I've said throughout this is having some kind of process to where if the community, for whatever reason, whatever threshold is, opposes it for whatever reason, then there's a process for the community to come together and address a single Little Free Library that may be going rogue of some sort. But the point is, I think we want to allow as many legal free libraries as we can have. So that's been my discussion from the beginning of this, and I hope we can get to that point. But I'll support either of these options that allows the Little Free Libraries to exist. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Young's already spoken, so let's do Mr. Kleinman has not.
Thank you. Many of my points have already been made.
Oh, my goodness.
But I will take out my pocket constitution. First Amendment, no law respecting an established religion prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So let's not abridge the freedom of the press, and let's just treat them as ornaments in the yard. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold has not.
Well, thank you. I am going to go on the record. I'm in with District 10. I want to, and I'm a library fanatic. Just for the record again, in response to Councilwoman Young, the constituent who talked about the mobile library, I want to go on record again that we voted against that. I did try to get that before us in some of those areas of that we need for literacy. But I do want to go on the record. We'll support freedom of speech, Mr. Kleinman. That's my background. But the concern that I have now is just what Councilman Magoo has expressed. There's a situation right now in my community, and we don't have many that I know of, but when you begin to talk about structures that are just sitting in the front yards and these other types of things, there are some communities that just structures in the front yard begin to impact our market values. And so then we begin to get the calls about why are they sitting there with that in the yard? Can't you get code on it and da-da-da-da-da-da? So we want to have some expectations of what I would think what it looks like, because it's not going to work as an ornament in everyone's neighborhood. Number two, we have a situation where have a community, I guess you call him a supporter, and he's been able to manipulate, if you will, his intentions on one of our schools where he has this structure sitting in front of the school. And we know that he's not really stable. So you are concerned about what goes in that box and what these children are able to access. And so that's kind of where my concern is in terms of just what's in the box, and it's not Jack in the box. Okay? So that's where my concerns would be in terms of just how far do we let them go and we not have any regulations, but I do support literacy. But I did want those comments to be on the record for those concerns of my constituents who don't want just you to put everything in the front yard, just like we don't want those accessory dwellings in the backyard. It does affect many elements of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Young.
Yes, just to make sure that I am clear, I know that my Dolphin Heights constituents are listening because they emailed me last night and said, please tell us we don't have to tell the kids that the library is no longer. So the motion that Mr. Griggs is making will establish that this is okay in front yards, or does that take a separate action?
That's my understanding, that it would allow these as permissible structures in the front yard without any dimensional requirements. Now, the only caveat would be, just like any type of structure, would be prohibited from any type of visibility triangle.
Would be prohibited from
or
what?
Driveway. Yes, would be prohibited from being located within a visibility triangle.
Okay.
And would have to be on private property.
Well, I will certainly be supporting that, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson.
I know we don't want to spend a whole lot more time on this, but if you allow them by right, you say you direct the staff, you say this is just going to be allowed by right, at some point you're going to get somebody who builds one that's 6 feet high and 6 feet wide and 3 feet deep, and Jack could hide in that box. And, you know, people do that. And so if you're going to allow this, then at least create some sort of mechanism by which if something goes in Or maybe they put that enormous thing right at the tippy edge of their yard and their next door neighbor doesn't want it there. Create some sort of way to address a concern if it does come up. And I don't know if that's some sort of waiver process. But I think in fairness, you have to allow some sort of redress for somebody. For instance, there were 11 complaints. Was it 11 complaints from the same man?
Same location, yes, ma'am.
Same location or same person who's complaining? If it's 11 complaints from one person, or is it 11 separate complaints?
Most of the complaints come in anonymous, so we're unable to tell if it's the same person. Just based on the tone of the writing, I think there were at least two people submitting service requests, but I can't tell you the number.
Okay. All right. Well, I think you ought to allow some sort of process by which if something gets out of hand, that the neighbors have some way to redress the situation. So then I would suggest that we allow the director to have the ability to do something. What would you suggest, Mr. Kossum?
I don't have a good suggestion on that, and I will defer to the attorney's office. I don't see how I'm empowered to require the removal of a structure that's legally permitted.
Well, I didn't necessarily mean remove it so much as modify it.
Well, again, I need to rely on my attorneys in terms of, before I get in too deep, speaking of due process and things I know nothing about. So it would be very challenging. But.
Or we could just go forward, allow them by right, and if a situation arises that is difficult and the neighbors don't want it there, then we can create some sort of mechanism?
Bert Vandenberg. There is really no means for us, if something is legally allowed, an illegally allowed structure, for us to force someone to modify their structure. I off the top of my head, I cannot think of a means.
Without dimensions or other criteria, we couldn't give the ability of the building or the director to modify something that's legal.
Okay. I just continue to be concerned that somebody's going to put up something that is not what we all would think is fine. You know, most of these, I'm sure 99% of these are great, and everybody loves them, and nobody wants to be against little free libraries, and neither do I. I just worry that someone's going to take advantage, and then the neighbors will have no recourse. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I was praying I didn't have to step in and say something, but and he wants to. How about that? Amen. Amen to that. But the problem in Pleasant Grove, Texas, folks, is that some of these folks think they can put everything they own out in the front yard. They got a tractor tire that they think is real pretty, and they'll paint it white, and they'll use it for a planter box. Then they'll put their swing set out there. And then they got all these other things, bird cages, and they're peeling paint. They're ugly, and they've got brick structures. And it's almost like a sense of pride, like I win, I got more stuff. And it's all in the front yard for all my neighbors to see. I've been dealing with this stuff forever. And if we open the Pandora's box, the little library, which is intended for good things, the unintended consequences is how do you tell one person legitimately, you know, you're okay, you got an old free library. Next guy, he's got another structure, a doghouse in the front yard. But all of a sudden, that's not okay. Would you speak to that, David? I mean, how do you assuage the difference between those two mentalities? I mean, what's good or acceptable or good or bad or whatever?
I don't have an answer. I mean, without some guidance in terms of the size, shape, whatever, of the structure. I think it's similar to the discussion we had recently on non-required fences. I mean, ultimately, somebody doesn't want vinyl in their front yard. Other folks don't want this in the front yard.
And let's say somebody in well intentions got their little free library there, but then they also have all these other things, and you're not going to be able to keep score and say, you know, you got to take all of that stuff out, but the the Little Free Library.
As I understand the motion, it would have to be that type of structure to be permitted, to be considered as outside storage, similar to lawn furniture, weatherproof materials that would be allowed in the front yard. So that would not necessarily allow a tarp covering lumber.
But theoretically, you could have a storage building in your front yard. You could have a doghouse in your front yard. You could have other kinds of structures that might not, maybe it's a little Girl Scout cookie, you know, an honorary system. You go put your money in and you get your cookies out, and they think that's a good idea. So that's not a free library.
I
don't know the answer. I'm just saying that it opens up a potential can of worms that we've been trying forever to close. Thanks.
Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Sweckard, can your code inspectors tell the difference between a little free library and front yard storage?
I would certainly prefer the definition to be very clear for them. I don't want them to have to interpret what they see in the field and make a determination if it's good, bad, if it's... I mean, the more specific direction they can receive...
I was so thinking you were going to say yes. In fact, your answer is... opened up so many other inquiries. I'm very sorry I weighed in, Mr. Mayor. Forget I have said anything.
Never ask a question you don't know the answer to. It's the old lawyer thing. Ms. Gates.
Wow. Thank you, Mayor. Okay, we've done one thing. We validated that government can't be reasonable or sensible. So, because it's just the onion keeps getting, it sounds like every question we ask, the peeled away at the more issues. I think I've got confidence in code in this area that they can determine junk from a little free library. I mean, unless they're going to put a lot of books in your junk, I mean, it's, you've got to at least have books to be a little free library. I still think this isn't, I mean, I understand your concerns. I had these concerns. It's bringing flashbacks of, if you can remember, Mr. Caraway and the rooster and the corn stalks and the crow and, and I had concerns that could start happening all over Dallas. And I don't think it has happened all over Dallas that we allow structures in your gardens. And I don't think this is going to be abused either. They're valid concerns. You want neighborhood integrity, but... and the environment of clean, but I just don't believe little free libraries is going to harm any neighborhood or any community, and it's in the benefit far outweighs any concern that you might have. To have access to books is a good thing. So I'm going to continue to be supportive of Mr. Griggs, and I think if it becomes a problem, we can look at it later and regulate it if necessary, but I just don't think that's the prudent thing to do at this time.
All right, let's take a record vote since this is contentious. Mr. Griggs' motion. Okay. We're voting on Mr. Griggs' motion to consider them front. What was the term?
Ornamental front yard. Accessories by right.
There we go.
All have voted on the motion. Voting in favor, Council Members Medrano, McGue, Thomas, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Wilson, Council Members Gates, Kleinman, Clayton, Mayor Rawlings, Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo, Council Members Kingston, Callahan, Grayson, Griggs, and Young. Voting no, Council Member Arnold. The motion carries.
Thank you. Next item.
Agenda item number 61 is a public hearing on the proposed sale of 9 unimproved properties acquired by the taxing authorities from the Sheriff to Dallas Housing Acquisition and Development Corporation, and at the close of the public hearing, authorize the city manager to, number one, quit claim 9 unimproved properties to Dallas Housing Acquisition and Development Corporation, and number two, release the city's non-tax liens included in the foreclosure judgment, together with post-judgment non-tax liens, if any. Are there any individuals in the audience that would like to speak on the item? No speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Intended motion, Ms. Arnold. Item Item 61. Could you turn your microphone on? Could you turn your microphone on? Thank you.
I would like to make a I am making a motion that we accept agenda item number 61.
Thank you. We got a motion and a second. Any discussion, Ms. Arnold?
No, sir. We're just trying to move forward and grow south. Thank you.
Thank you. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Mr. Mayor, all items have been considered. We now move back to our speakers. We do have some remaining speakers from the morning session under the additional open microphone category. And they are Sarah Mokaria, Seth Hewlett, Tom Gibbons, and Kenneth Altiz. I will first recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must adhere to the same rules of propriety and decorum applicable to the members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, profane, or slanderous remarks will be removed from the session of the meeting. You are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the timer on the podium. When your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. If you do have any handouts, it's important that you go ahead and hand them to our officers now, as it does affect your speaking time. Ms. Mokaria, state your name and address for the record. 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Sarah Mokaria, 8918 Brettshire Drive. Today I'm speaking on behalf of as a co-founder of Mothers Against Police Brutality. I want to talk a little bit about one of the proposals that we have. They're coming around. I think you've all seen them before. If not, you can also read them online on our website. Some form of random drug testing already exists and is in current practice with the Dallas Police Department. We are proposing that a drug test happens for every officer that uses deadly force. Officers who discharge their weapon or use significant non-deadly force against a suspect or person in custody should be drug tested within an hour of the incident. The results of this test will address the key factor of an officer's state of mind upon the use of excessive or deadly force against a member of the public. Such tests are routinely done on the person who is shot or who the deadly force is used against, and those tests are the results of those tests are released to the media. But we rarely understand what the state of that officer was when this happens. An officer's drug test is no less relevant for understanding what actually happened in an officer-involved shooting and should be released forthwith. The St. Louis Police Department recently enacted such a policy for to drug test officers in a shooting or involved in a car wreck. Police officers who are taking psychiatric drugs should also be required to provide a list of their current medications to the department's personnel office. Prescription drug use is a growing nationwide problem, and there is no reason to believe that officers are different from the general public in their potential for misuse of prescription drugs. There have been numerous reports in recent years of police officers abusing steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs. These drugs, when abused, can lead to hyper-aggressive behavior. No policy change that you make today will bring my father, Tesfaye Mokaria, back. Two officers killed him on October 7th, 1992, when I was 10 years old. I was standing behind him, along with my mother and my baby sister. Nothing you can do will ever bring him back or take away the tragedy that our family has and continues to experience because of his loss. But we can change and create changes so that this doesn't happen in our city anymore. As we all know, our city has been the place of too much tragedy with the police officers who died. And then also, since the police officers have died, we've had 4 officer-involved shootings. We have to stop the violence, and you have the ability to do that, and Mothers Against Police Brutality, which is a national organization, is here to help. So I hope that you take in these policies into consideration, and we're happy to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seth Hewlett. Mr. Hewlett will be followed by Tom Gibbons, Kenneth Altiz.
My name is Seth Hewlett. I reside at 2944 Etta Drive. I want to thank the City Council, the Mayor, the City's Office, and the people for allowing me to speak about this very important subject, saving lives. There's two methods of saving lives. We can lower the police brutality rates and highway casualty rates. On lowering police brutality rates, we are able to do that by dividing policy into pre-apprehend, apprehend, and post-apprehend. If you get pre- and post-apprehend up to 85% and apprehend at 100%, police brutality rates drop. Well, in the one place it was implemented, it dropped to zero. So it will at least have a significant effect, possibly dropping 50%, and hoping maybe it will drop to zero. On lowering highway casualty rates, the way in which we can do that is having the agency look into journal articles and focus on the driving that causes the highest casualties. Now, the Ohio troopers have already done that, so we can do an inter-office or interdepartmental, and ask them for their policies. We can then work with UNT and UTA to actually expand it to all streets, not just highways. That also dropped the highway casualty rates. Now, I haven't spoken to the city manager's office yet, but on the police brutality, as I said, the one place that it was implemented, the rate did drop to zero. It did have, and I don't know if any of you guys have any questions, but I'm looking forward to the council. I don't have a proposal on it, but I'm looking forward to working with the council or the city managers to try to get this implemented. And I guess I'm actually done speaking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Tom Gibbons. Not present. Kenneth Altice. Stephanie Hansen and Paula Hutchison will follow, with Ms. Hutchison being the final speaker.
Hello, council members and mayor. Thank you so much for allowing me to address you. My name is Kenneth Altice. I am here on behalf of my 87-year-old mother, Jeanette Altice, owner for the last 56 years of our house at 3960 Cobblestone. On August 10th, Inspector Davis issued a citation that the brush was placed on the curb ahead of time. Chapter 8 of the City Code states that the trash should be placed just behind the curb line on the street abutting the property. As you can see from this picture, the trash was at least 8 feet from the edge of the street, and we put it there waiting for the opportunity to put it out. In fact, the next Tuesday, I was out with a neighbor talking, and a city worker who had come to collect the trash, the bulky trash, yelled out to me and said, "Hey, if you want me to take the trash, you need to put it out on the curb." I did that, and he took it. There is a penalty of $261 for this. This is a significant amount of money for my mother, who is almost totally dependent on Social Security. I checked the next week to see Mr. Sweckert, by the way, he's still here, has been delightfully polite and helpful to me. So I want to thank him for that. He told me that he was going to recommend that the city attorney not accept it or not prosecute it. And he said, "You can check it online." I checked. I may have made a mistake. It wasn't there. I assumed that it was pulled as the director had asked. Then I get a letter 2 days ago saying that, you didn't show up. And Mr. Swaggart says he sent me a letter saying that it was on or back on the agenda, whatever. I didn't see it. Could be my mistake. There is an appeals process that I just learned about. Now, these pictures so far have been the way the trash was when we got the citation. Someone working for my mother bagged these things up. I did some additional work and put all of the brush on the, well, in this case, the right side towards the center of the property. Here is where I moved it after the city attorney, his name was, Nemo, I've got it in my notes, Nero. And so this is what it looks like when you put it on the curb, I think. In any case, that's the summation of it. I asked Mr. Swegert what it means to have it on the just behind the curb line of the street abutting the property is the language. And there isn't a description.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I was going to suggest you speak to Mr. Swicker, but it sounds like you have.
I have.
So, Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for coming down here. I'm sorry. I think you live in Austin. Is that correct? And you had to travel from there to...
I am now temporarily living with my mother, although I've got business in Austin.
And I know you've reached out to my office, and I'm sorry that our hands are kind of tied. We can't interfere after a citation has been written. I know we referred you to Mr. Swickert, and I think there was a miscommunication. He can't remove it from the docket. It has to be processed. But if the circumstances, if they're explained, usually, or the judge has that determination to dismiss the case. I don't know. I mean, I'll talk with Mr. Swickert if there's anything else we can do at this point. There's a lot of rationale for why we don't. There's only two code violations that we don't give warnings, that we just give a citation immediately, and this is one because people were abusing that warning process. And I do get a lot of complaints about this. It is very, very frustrating, and I apologize. I think we've looked at quality of life of trying to make it a little bit better and not have people like you and your mother be penalized when you're not really the offenders we're going after, but we're challenged to try to make that work. So I'll talk with him and get an update for you, but thank you for coming down and speaking to us today.
Thank you very much.
And letting all of my council members know that it is very frustrating when violations like this occur.
Thank you, council members.
Thank you.
Thank you, council.
Your next speaker, Stephanie Hansen. Ms. Hansen, coming forward. Paula Hutchison will follow.
My name is Stephanie Hansen. I live at 1914 Noma Street, Dallas, Texas, 75212. On previous times here at City Hall, I have come to speak about events such as zoning and traffic management plans and other things that are impacting West Dallas. Today, I not only come as president of a neighborhood association and Crime Watch, I also come as a resident of HMK Properties. The reason I am a resident of HMK Properties is because 6 years ago, in 2010, my mother was diagnosed with stomach cancer, and I had to downsize. I had a home in Greenleaf Subdivision. I didn't have a problem with downsizing because my mother was my life and my son. So I downsized, and the only place that was available was HMK Properties. I did some fix-up on the properties myself. I put hundreds of dollars worth of paint into the house, and I made it a home. I bought new curtains, and I made it something that we could be proud of when people walked into the home. In the 6 years, Crash has not done any repairs in the house. I presently have a $900 to $1,000 water bill. I am aware of the Chapter 27 revisions because I have attended every meeting that was put in our neighborhood regarding Chapter 27. And today I say it's a shame that the very chapter that was put there to supposedly help us is the one that's being used to hurt us. And yes, I'm upset. I'm angry. I did allow code to come into my house thinking that things were going to be made better, thinking that Creche was going to be held accountable. And we are now suffering the consequences. As the judge said, we are now the collateral damage that is occurring. I have no idea where I would go. I'm independent, and I can't imagine living with a daughter or anyone else. I am disabled, I am a veteran, and I take care of an adult autistic son. My story is one of the smaller stories of only 6 years. Others have many more years. For a woman who has lived in HMK property since she was 16 years old, and she's now 80, there are so many things that need to be looked at in this situation. Creche did make us some offers, and those offers, we need to be brought to the table also. We should not have to get legal lawyers to come to the table. And no one has asked us what we want as tenants. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down. Ms. Arnold.
Yes, I want to make sure that before she looks, I want you to wait here because we have some information for you. On Saturday, we held just a symposium, if you will, for those individuals, not only in the southern sector, but we made it available to those in the west. Resources that we have and some partners who are reaching out. So we do have some partners who have some locations. And we're willing to talk to you about helping you to relocate if that's what you want to do, but just help. If you don't want to do that, he also has information on how to help you. So I want to make sure you don't leave here and that I talk to you. But what our constituents need to understand, and I know Councilwoman Alonzo has heard this, but we do have the legal restrictions, and we can't go into a whole lot of it. But when you have individuals who are told that they can purchase a property, a substandard property, for $45,000, $45,000. These constituents don't have that, and then Mr. Koresh would be the banker. And so you're caught in a catch-22 if they did have the means to purchase the property. My understanding is that they would inherit all of the responsibilities of upgrading. So this is a difficult position to be in. And I know many of us live where we live, and that's where we want to live. So let me reach out to you right now. My assistant is coming, and we're going to see if we can partner up with someone who is willing and committed to helping you. They don't want anything from the city. They just want to help the constituents. And at this point, that's who we're putting a call out to, those who just want to help you, those of you who want to be helped. Thank you, Mayor, for allowing me to say that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Next speaker.
Paula Hutchison.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Paula Hutchison. I'm a property owner in West Dallas, 507 West Main Street, Dallas, Texas. I'm also a retired United States Navy veteran. My mother built our home in 1945. It's still there. And I revamped my mother's home when I brought her home in 2002. I did all the plumbing, all the wiring. I disallowed the gas because when AT&T ran a cable under our home without our permission, they broke our gas line and left my mother an $800 gas bill, which they never paid, and she didn't complain to me about. I may have been able to take care of it. But I'm also here as chairperson under West Dallas One Steering Committee for Housing. And we just want to just present some thoughts and some ideas that we hope will be taken into consideration. One option is, and I'm hearing and reading, to allow our residents under the HMK problem that exists to remain in their homes until the school term ends. We're hoping and praying that that will be the process because many children would have to change schools, and that's difficult. Housing department could allocate funding that could subsidize residents that are affected by the sale of HMK properties. I don't know, we're a rich nation. I mean, 500,000, maybe $8,000 or even $1 million. I don't know. to utilize existing rental properties to subsidize and help these 300 or more people who are being affected by this process and allow them at least 6 to 12 months to kind of stabilize themselves and find reasonable housing such as that Ms. Arnold mentioned. And then HMK is asking for negotiations with the city, with our government here, to take the penalties off of the table, and then he can be more reasonable in terms of looking out for the humanity of these people. And then I read the article where it said, Ms. Alonzo, I love you, and that the mayor and Ms. Arnold said that our goal is the well-being of our tenants is our first and only priority right now. So I'm hoping that that can truly come to fruition. I had looked at districts that border 6, and you got 1, 3, 4, 6, 7, and 8. And so houses like my mother's will be affected by the new Chapter 27 because people park cars, they build jack-in-the-box like you guys talked about a while ago, and also little free libraries, which we love. And so many penalties will come forth for residents, and they don't know it's coming down the line. So we're here to communicate, educate our community. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming down. Meeting's adjourned at 3:15.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Wilson wanted to announce something.
I just wanted to announce to all my colleagues and invite you to the grand opening of Save-A-Lot tomorrow, 11 a.m. at 3540 Simpson Stewart Road. Come out and enjoy.
Nice. The grocery store in Southern Dallas.